Cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome aboard to this Thursday evening edition of Head On. I am Bob Kincaid, and I am feeling considerably more relaxed right now. It's always good when you have to deal with the uncertainty of a medical procedure and have it turn out well. First and foremost, thank you to all of you, many, many, many of you, who sent kind wishes to Ferg as he had that useless piece of evolutionary detritus removed from his abdomen. It was successful, and I got to tell you, from the Never a Dull Moment department, just so you can know, I think I'm responsible for this. Because, you know, from about a year ago, last May, I found out, and no, it was last July, I guess, I found out that on the inside, I am bass-ackwards, literally. Well, Ferg isn't. I didn't pass that much genetic information along to him. But it turns out that when the doc got inside and tried to get at his appendix, he'd pull it with the forceps, and it would just, bing, snap back. That was because the blood supply to his appendix was wrapped around his appendix. The surgeon came out, looked at Ferg's mother and me, and said, you know, I haven't seen one of those in ages. Play the lottery tonight. It was, of course, too late to go play the lottery, but I got his meaning. But it all went well. Ferg insisted on having some cool photographs of his innards to take to school for show and tell, so the surgeon kindly obliged. Nice young man. And so it appears that we successfully navigated and negotiated the American healthcare system with no lasting ill effect. That's me knocking wood. Yeah, I'm rational. Thanks to all of you who wrote and called and wished Ferg well in this medical adventure of his. I was a nervous wreck. His mother was a nervous wreck. Although his mother is much stronger than I, so she, you know, that's why she's a mama. Women are stronger, smarter, and it's been 2 million years of human evolution and the males of the species compensating. What's that? What's that, woman? You are stronger than me and smarter than me? Well, I will go out and club something in the head with a rock. See? Showed you. That's guys. And we basically had to take over the whole society, over the whole planet, in order to get over our insecurities. And we're still there. Working on it, but still there. So that's what went on. And Fergus is feeling better. He's walking around some. The Lortabs are kicking in, and they seem to be doing what it is they are supposed to do. So with any luck at all, he'll be feeling better in a day or two. But right now, he's higher than a loblolly pine and sore as heck. But thank you very much to all of you for your concerns. Tonight, we have a guest at 6:30. because we've been talking for quite some time now, you and I, about what a green economy looks like. And so we're going to find out what a little bit of that vision is. And we're going to find out from somebody who really ought to know. Dr. Thomas J. Krieger will be on the program at the bottom of the hour. And he is the new provost and expert on the Green Workplace Representative Certificate Program at the National Labor College. The National Labor College is a real, live, honest-to-goodness college that is operated by the AFL-CIO, and they grant degrees in things like labor organizing and labor organization management and labor history, and they have recently added a certificate program in green workplace representation. This is where the green economy will begin. And I think it's very, very exciting. So we'll be talking with Dr. Krieger, who has vast and impressive credentials. He has, among other things, been director of research and legislation for the United University Professions. That's the largest higher education union in the country. They represent more than 30,000 faculty and staff of the State University of New York. He's also served as assistant to the president of UUP, United University Professions. And he's been associate budget director for research and policy for the State University of New York. And he's written, being a scholar, lots of scholarly articles and presentations and publications. So also a member of Pi Sigma Alpha, the National Political Science Honor Society. So he spent a lot of time looking at what a green workplace looks like. And I look forward to Dr. Krieger sharing that information with us. There are some things out there that I think are rather interesting this evening that we will get to in addition to our conversation. And hopefully that you will find those things scintillating. I'm sorry, I'm a little addled right now because I'm getting weird messages from my internet connection. It acts like it went away, and then I got logged out of chat. But anyway, it appears that I am back. And I just want to throw something out for your consideration from the, from the stupidity department. Just saying. Nothing earth-shaking, not monumental. Just asking. You remember a few weeks back, when the photos came out of Michael Phelps holding a bong and Kellogg's and so forth had a hissy and dumped his contract. He's a smoking that marijuana. And they canceled his multi-million dollar endorsement contract and pulled all the boxes off the shelf. We can't have the children of America seeing a man who smokes marijuana on the box on their box of commercially provided for-profit cornflakes. It sets a bad example. Remember that? Yeah, and it was stupid then, and it's still stupid. And Kellogg's is stupid. Well, they are an American corporation, after all. So being an American corporation, they will find a way to make a fast buck out of this. They pulled them from the shelves, but now they've got themselves a tasty little the crunchy corn write-off. Because the Kellogg Corporation has donated thousands upon thousands upon thousands of boxes of cornflakes with Michael Phelps' photograph on them to the San Francisco Food Bank. Yes, that's right. It would be dangerous for children to see Michael Phelps' picture on a box of cereal that they bought in a grocery store, but it is not dangerous for hungry people to see that pothead on their giveaway food at the food bank. Sorry, I got a problem. This is the food bank executive director, Paul Ash, is tickled pink to have the cornflakes. He says they don't get that sort of thing very often. If you've got kids, you buy cereal, and if you've bought cereal lately, you know that it's priced daily just like gold. Buy cereal now. There's never been a better time to invest in cereal. Cereal is your best hedge against inflation. Buy cereal now. Sorry, can't resist. The Marijuana Policy Project has issued a statement. Rob Kampla is the group's executive director. He said, Kellogg's had no problem signing up Phelps when he had a conviction for drunk driving, an illegal act that could actually have killed someone. To drop him for choosing to relax with a substance that's safer than beer is an outrage, and it sends a dangerous message to young people. But it's not dangerous for them if they are poor in America and there's no profit being... But see, they got a tax write-off, Kellogg's did, for donating this. This way, they look like... Oh, they're a caring American corporation. And there's some little bean counter high up in the Kellogg Tower in Battle Creek, Michigan, if it's not in India by now, who just insured his Christmas bonus by giving pot-smoking Michael Phelps picture-tainted boxes of cereal to a food bank in San Francisco. Yeah, really not kidding. I think I'll scream. So that's enough of that. But I just thought that when you see something that is so overtly ignorant, it is difficult indeed not to notice it. Other things out there, you know, you think in 2009 we might be past the stupidity of 2003 and the dirty, filthy lies that led us to the Iraq War. How about that? Cornflakes to lies about the Iraq War. Can I segue a story or what? But we're not.
Look, I think when people look back on the Bush years, is that a fair standard? The one thing people are going to remember the most is that he kept us safe. We have not been attacked since September 11th. The second is, as I said, Barack Obama should be thankful that he's inherited a world without Saddam Hussein in it. The third part is troublesome.
We were attacked on your watch. If you start getting into who was attacked when, we suffered the worst domestic calamity in history on your watch. If you get into this, whose watch was good, you guys blew it. I don't know if you can do it that way.
Chris, how dare you? If we get attacked again, are you going to say we got attacked on Barack Obama's watch? We got attacked on
terrorists. I'm using the word the way you're using it. You're saying
what you just did is shameful.
You're bragging about the fact we weren't hit.
That's exactly right.
How can you brag about...
That's what people are going to remember about President Bush's administration.
Well, they don't remember that because his popularity went down to about one of the lowest in American history. He's down near the bottom of American presence because people believe that he didn't do a good job.
Hey, just asking, remember when Jon Stewart went on Crossfire and looked at that little right-wing slug and said, don't be a dick? Yeah, what was his name? Tucker Carlson, the guy that's out of work and living under a bridge somewhere drinking screw-top wine. Waving the tattered last vestiges of his little bow tie around. Yeah, don't be a dick. Look at this, two dicks.
Let's go back to your standard.
Hey, Chris,
I'm not saying anything. Don't say I'm being shameful here. But just
look at substance.
Ari, you can't set up a standard and then not live by it. If the standard is we didn't get hit.
Who's talking?
What?
Who's talking?
If you set up a standard,
did you care to not live by it, Chris Matthews?
Yeah.
You know, Chris, I don't recall you saying that James Carville, Paul Begala, those people shouldn't be on the air defending their boss. But here you are questioning why people like me would be out there saying things about my boss.
Well, because
slam dunk, Chris. There are two sides
to
every issue.
Okay, good. Fair enough.
I get to present that side. I believe this still today, and of course you and I disagree with it, but after September 11th, having been hit once, how could we take a chance that Saddam might not strike again?
Oh! It is 2009. It is March of 2009. It is six long years since we began the rape, the murder, the plunder, the pillage, and the slaughter of the innocents in Iraq. And Ari Fleischer sits before a camera, running his gaping filth hole, and says, but after September 11th, having been hit once, how could we take a chance that Saddam Hussein might not strike again? Again. See, it's another one of those why I don't believe in the fundamentalist God moments. Or any other gods for that matter. Because when you lie like that about something that has gotten a million people dead, if the guy up there with the thunderbolts was paying attention, Zeus, Yahweh, Jehovah, Ihweh, whatever, Allah, the Ganesh, whatever, any of them, if they were sitting up there, they'd do something about it. And there'd be nothing but, you know, a little cloven spot where Ari Fleischer's little bald pate used to be, just again. How could we take a chance that Saddam Hussein might not strike again? Breathtaking, isn't it? Breathtaking when you think of the mothers, the fathers, the brothers, the sisters, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins, the wives, the sons, the daughters, who saw men and women go away from this country in uniform, never to return, based upon a lie that should have Ari Fleischer, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, George Bush, and the whole filthy gang of them standing in a dock somewhere answering to the charges of crimes against humanity. And then, of course, there's the Cy Hirsch revelations. Murder Incorporated operating out of the office of the vice president with no oversight whatsoever. The CIA engaged in domestic spying. But we can't prosecute them. Why? There are sound cases to be made. If you listen to the last hour on the horn, to Mark Levine's program, you know there are sound cases to be made for prosecution. Vincent Bugliosi has been on this program and laid out part and parcel, point by point by point, why it is possible and how it is possible and why it must be done that people like George Bush must be prosecuted for murder, what Shakespeare called heady murder. So that's where we begin this evening. We will take a decidedly more labor-oriented tack here in about 13 minutes. But for now, let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, hey, it's Sandra.
Sandra, what's up?
Listen to the show.
Trying to not put a fist through a wall, I know.
I don't understand how they cannot prosecute. I mean, I don't really care about their wanting to move forward. I mean, if this is a constitutional republic, rule of law and all that shit,
yeah.
Then, I mean, he has to, you know, the Justice Department, I mean, the hell with the administration, the Justice Department, which is like the enforcing arm of our government, isn't it?
Well, it is, and for all the talk of moving forward, we can't be looking at the past, we've got to move forward. Failing to deal with clear crimes that were committed against the people of this nation and against the world is not moving forward. That is, in fact, retrograde motion. That's motion toward tyranny, motion toward dictatorship.
I mean, it's just, the whole thing is just incredible. I mean, we knew that the revelations would come out and that it would be really ugly, but you know, this is just straight up, law breaking, and the bad economy can't be used as a cover. I mean, these people need to be dealt with, because I don't want to be just hoping that we get reasonable people in power. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. And
they need to prosecute. And I hate it being framed as this only a concern of the left. You know, that's a straw man if I've ever heard.
Well, you know, but how can it be? That's a framing issue, Sandra.
Yeah,
that's a failure in framing, because we have an example from 13 years ago of a profound concern for the rule of law by the right. And that had to do with a consensual sex act, a stained blue dress, and a lie told in a deposition.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, it just really undermines, you know, what kind of government we actually have now, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm starting to believe that that Wolin guy is right. I mean, he wrote this book about inverted totalitarianism and talked about it, you know, the U.S. now as an example of it. And I'm starting to think, you know, he may be onto something because, you know, we're not being represented. I don't know what is running this country. You know what I'm saying? Obama, I don't really give a hell who it is at this point. It's kind of like he's not really doing his job, and they seem to be paying more attention to the capital markets. And this country's more than just capital markets. You know what I'm saying?
So much more. I watched, you know, over the last 48 hours, Sandra, I've had a chance to watch how much more than capital markets this country is at a little rural hospital in West Virginia.
And you have a crisis?
Oh, yeah. My son had his appendix out last night. But that was last night was after more than 24 other hours of trying to find out what the hell was wrong and watching people come and go through an emergency room. And seeing people who have to use the emergency room as their primary care physician. You know, you were carving meat off of a ham hock and the knife slipped and you laid your thumb open. And it's not an emergency, but it's bleeding and it needs stitches. But we've got a medical care system that says they got to go to the emergency room because they're poor.
I hope your son is doing okay.
Yeah, he is. He's a little buzzed and still really sore, but he's getting along.
Well, no, because, I mean, in this situation that we're in, you know, an appendix can be a death sentence if you don't have access. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so I'm really glad that you're able to.
Well, we only, you know, we at the little rural hospital where we went to, Sandra, we only had about a seven-hour wait in the emergency room.
Yeah.
You know, at places like Grady in Atlanta.
Mm.
Or Mass General, or some of the other huge hospitals that treat folks who don't have coverage and so forth, hospitals in New York, Chicago, et cetera. It's not unusual to have 24 to 48 hour waits, and we've had all the stories where people have dropped dead waiting for treatment in the emergency room.
Yeah,
we were lucky.
No, that seems to be the. You know, the sort of running story, and it's kind of like, you know, when I heard that the people who want to talk about single payer were, you know, last minute allowed after they made a ruckus, you know, I just thought, you know, what is this? Because it doesn't really make any sense to do what they're talking about doing, this sort of middleman. It needs to be straight up single payer. Why are we still coddling these sort of industries like this? It's the banks.
I wish I knew. You know, the Medicare for All Act has been out there for years now. John Conyers reintroduces it every Congress. But we're dealing with those knuckle walkers in this country who hold this country back from going forward. We're dealing with the 20% that still thinks George Bush is a Christian man.
Well, no, and
they think that having access to health care is somehow going to have people singing the Internationale in the streets and putting up statues of Lenin.
No, I mean, well, this is a different thing, but it's still related. I watched this sort of documentary of how women got to vote. You know, it went from Seneca Falls to 1920 when it passed. It was just like the same people back then were holding it back. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, there's an element that's always been in this country that wants to make sure this country does not go forward.
Yeah, it's the same people now. When I saw that guy talking about, oh, healthcare is a privilege, remember that blur?
Remember that
guy? The other day, I was just like, oh, you know what? You really, I don't know if he put his foot in it or his realness just showed. You know, I was like, oh, okay. Thank you. We do, you know, this is what they are, you know. That's what they are. Healthcare is a privilege.
And what they are is heartless monsters.
No, they're horrible. And I, you know, I just feel like we're just, yeah, it's just some sort of endless nightmare. And this sort of not prosecuting these criminals,
Yeah, no patience.
I don't really get it. Trust me, if they every time they do polls, they find a majority are like, yeah, can we please prosecute? You know what I mean?
I know.
It's not like it's just, a hand.
No, it's not. It's not just the right-wing nut jobs. They've succeeded in getting it out to the rest of the country. Sandra, I've got to roll along because I've got a guest coming at 6:30. But
okay, no problem.
I hope maybe I'll hear from you tomorrow night or soon.
I'll give you a call soon.
All right, take care, Sandra.
Okay, bye.
Bye now. And yeah, I do have to make preparations to get Dr. Krieger on the line. But before we do that, just a little observation. Yeah, it's always nice to see people in other countries holding up the rule of law. There's a movement in Canada to either ban George Bush from entering Canada or to arrest him when he arrives. There's a lawyer in Vancouver named Gail Davidson because George is going to speak on St. Patty's Day. The torturer's gone to Canada to talk on St. Patty's Day. He's going to Canada to speak in Alberta, Calgary. And Gail Davidson says that the law of Canada is such that being credibly accused of supporting torture is enough to keep you out of Canada under Canada's Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. He said, quote, the test isn't whether the person's been convicted, but whether there's some reasonable grounds to think that they have been involved. Good on you, Gail Davidson. Proud of you. George Bush, St. Patrick's Day. Oh. Honest to God, Barack Obama is more Irish than George Bush.
But Barrack's as Irish as was JFK. His granddaddy's daddy came from Monaco, a small Irish village well known to you all. Turlew, 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 turlelama. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. He's as Irish as bacon and cabbage and stew. He's a Hawaiian, he's Kenyan, American. He's in the White House, he took his chance. Now let's see Barrack do river dance. Turlew, 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 turlelama. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. From Kerry and Cork to old Donegal, let's hear it for Barrack from old Donegal. From the lakes of Killarney to old Connemara, there's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hare and O'Hara. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. From the old Barry Stone to the great hill of Tara. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama.
2008, the White House is free. They're cheering in Mayo and in Skibbereen. The Irish in Kenya and in Yokohama are cheering for President Barack Obama.
O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hare and O'Hara. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama.
The hockey mom's gone, and so is McCain. They're cheering in Texas and Boris O'Kay. In Monaco town, the greatest of drama for our famous President Barack Obama. The great Stephen Neal, a great man of God. He proved that Barack was from the outside. They came by bus, they came by car. Celebrate Barack in Ollie Hayes Bar.
O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hare and O'Hara. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Hare and O'Hara. There's no one as Irish as Barack Obama.
There's a little village in Ireland where my great-great-great-great grandfather came from. So I'm looking forward to going there and having a fight.
Sure, and don't you know, after 8 long, tortured years, it's awfully nice to have a son of the old sod back in the White House.
So, if that doesn't get your toes tapping, what will? So, enjoy. So now we move on to the conversation I told you about at the beginning of the program. Joining us here in just a second or two is Dr. Thomas J. Krieger. He is many things that I have described for you earlier, but most recently, he is the National Labor College's new provost and expert on the upcoming Green Workplace Representative Certificate Program. And I'm looking forward to this conversation because we've been talking about how the economy changes when people have to have jobs dealing with the transition toward a green economy and the fact that a green economy is really the one thing that will turn this nation around more than anything else. So welcome to the program, Dr. Thomas J. Krieger. Dr. Krieger, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Wow, thanks, Bob. Thanks for that introduction. It's very nice.
Like I said in the intro, we've been talking about this issue of the green economy and transitioning toward it. And tell us a little bit, as a starter, what's involved in a Green Workplace Representative Certificate?
Let me just say, by sort of explaining the program, that we are working with the AFL-CIO Center for Green Jobs. It's a new initiative that was just introduced at a conference here in Washington called Green Jobs, Good Jobs in early February.
I was there.
And it's part of an effort by the labor movement to take a larger role in the climate debate. I've been the AFL-CIO that have been very active in this issue for a while. And they were very active. The whole organization was very active in this conference. Our role at the National Labor College, as you said, is the Green Workplace Representative Program. It's a new addition that we're just doing the curriculum development for our curriculum. We're looking to offer courses perhaps starting in the fall if we can get all the, the T's crossed and the I's dotted. It's kind of like a Green Shop Stewards program. People would be trained. First, we'd offer kind of broad-based education in environmental policy, a little history on labor movement, environmental movement cooperation. And then we would go in a variety of areas, energy, recycling, water usage, transportation, buildings, workplace, and, to give people an education in what they can do to make their work sustainable, make their companies and employers more profitable, and also do something good for the environment.
Well, this is brilliant, far-reaching, broad-thinking stuff, Dr. Krieger. How did it come in? What was the impetus for getting this started?
We've been in discussions with the AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO was active in a conference in Poznan back in the fall on climate change, and there's been various people, officers and staff at the AFL-CIO, and a lot of the affiliates are doing this already. They're working on energy. They're working on solar power. I don't want to start naming them because whenever you name someone, you leave them off the list. And
right.
A lot of unions are very active in this. So there, it's kind of a coordinated effort on the part of the AFL-CIO, and that's where the Center for Green Jobs came out of. And we're partnering with them, and that's where the impetus for this program came from.
Do you see green jobs and the green economy as being a potential boost or a potential benefit for organized labor in this country?
I do. I mean, we all know that if you look at the history of labor in the United States, that there's no guarantee that a job is a good job. I mean, what really makes jobs good jobs are unions. And, if you apply that logic to the idea of green jobs, there's people that are claiming there's going to be a lot of jobs out there in retrofitting houses and all of those, in various of making this country more sustainable, of redoing the electrical grid, retrofitting houses and buildings to make them more energy efficient. So there'll be jobs out there, but whether these, if you qualify them as green, I mean, the general definition of a green job is anything that really contributes to, in a positive way, toward climate change. But, you know, it's going to be the labor movement that's going to make those green jobs good jobs, you know, sustainable jobs, because I think it's a really great idea, and it's something the labor movement's been doing for a long time. You have to think of, you know, not just sustainable products, but sustainable people, right? These are jobs that are going to keep families employed and keep them in their homes, you know, allow people to, you know, go out and buy things and be productive, good members of the economy and of the country.
Well, you talked about the involvement of a number of different labor organizations
yes.
in this process. Is this also is labor taking and through the program that you've developed with NLC, are you taking a tack a transitory tack, transitioning away from the more climate or climate, environment, and frankly humanity harming practices, and moving toward things that can not only keep people at work but put more people to work?
Yes, absolutely. And I think when we end up, what our curriculum will really be, as I start to survey this and put together the component parts of it, our curriculum will really showcase what the AFL-CIO affiliates are doing in innovative ways around the country to do exactly that, to introduce, you know, new processes in installation buildings in the construction trades and things, to make buildings more efficient, to use solar power, to reuse water, transportation. I mean, the steel workers have been involved in the Blue Green Alliance for many years. So your members, or listeners probably have heard of that. It was an alliance between the Sierra Club and the steel workers. Now there's other unions that have recently joined, and that's recently expanded. And that's what you described was the basic idea behind that, you know, to kind of rethink of how we do things in a way so we put people to work in good jobs and we do something positive for the environment at the same time.
Dr. Krieger, of course, the Horn, as you may have been told, is headquartered in West Virginia.
Yes.
And there are a lot of – I am one of those people who is the son, grandson, great-grandson, et cetera, of UMWA miners.
Sure. Can I just interject there that my great-grandfather was a coal miner, too, in Pennsylvania?
Exactly.
From Poznan over in Prussia and was a miner in Pennsylvania.
And you know, what a heritage that is, because it really speaks. My grandfather, for instance, was very active in his local for many, many years.
Sure.
And passed on through the family the value of union membership. But I tell you, being a West Virginian, I fret because I have great love for the UMWA.
Sure.
I fret about them, and we talk about these transitions. You know, we've seen time and time again in the coal fields. You see it in Pennsylvania. I've seen it in West Virginia. It happens in Kentucky, Virginia, Tennessee, Alabama.
Yep.
When the coal company ups and leaves, when the coal plays out, they bug out, and
that's correct.
And it's devil take the hindmost for the workers. That as we talk about a green economy, Dr. Krieger, what can we do in terms of transitioning the hardworking folks of the UMWA,
yeah,
for instance,
yeah,
into a green economy?
That's great. It's a great question, and you can call me Tom. I prefer Tom.
Oh, okay, Tom.
And that's a great question. I think that's one of the $64,000 questions that confronts policymakers and union leaders and everyone today. Let me just give you one example from Pennsylvania that I know I heard about at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference. There are, and this is just one example, but it's an example that really I hope would, and I think a lot of people as well, will dictate policy coming out of the Obama administration in a way to transition this shift that's what you described of companies leaving and replacing them with new production of green jobs. In eastern Pennsylvania right now, there are steel workers in a steel plant that was shut down who are working today to make turbines for windmills for sustainable wind energy production. And that's the kind of thinking I think we need. And, you know, this is not just me coming up with this. This is, I think there's a broad consensus of this across the labor movement, and hopefully in Congress and among policymakers, that that's the kind of investment that should come out of this Recovery Act out of Washington, is really to look at places where you've had displaced workers and people out of work and some real, what you describe, some real economic dislocation, and to begin to think in terms of green production, of, you know, semiconductors, you know, in plants that are closed down, for relays and things, for a new energy grid, for solar panels in places where people are out of work and, you know, skilled people are out of work in factories. New building design, like the LEED building design for energy efficient buildings in places where construction workers are out of work. That should really be, in my mind, the guiding philosophy of this, because it's an assumption, I think, and I don't think this is going to happen. That's not a necessity, but I think it could happen as an assumption that these green jobs are jobs that are going to put people here in the United States back to work, and that's important.
As President Obama has noted, we invented all the technology, and then the rest of the world took off with it.
Yeah.
And that's an infrastructure that's going to have to be built largely from the ground up in those empty factories you just discussed. In terms of the youth of America,
right,
and growing the union movement that way, Is there any consideration within, because I understand that the curriculum of this certificate program is still a work in progress.
Correct.
Is there any thinking along the lines of how we incorporate training the next generation coming out of high school, for instance, how we train them for green economy jobs?
Sure. Well, not specifically. I mean, our student population here tend to be people that have been involved in the labor movement. Many of them are leaders and officers in unions. But the one thing I noticed, which I think is very important along the lines that you just raised, is when I went to the Green Jobs Conference, there's a lot of young people there. And I know I have my son's going to be 13, and the kids in his school, he's going into seventh grade. Are really in tune with environmental issues. And I noticed a lot of young people at this conference. And I think that's a good opportunity for the labor movement to really, through the Center for Green Jobs and the new efforts in the labor movement on environmental issues and climate change, to really attract young people and the interest of young people and to, bring them along to the idea of unions in the process.
I was thinking in terms of, virtually every union has an apprenticeship program.
Correct.
And how someone who, say, attends NLC and becomes certified in this process, how that translates to, say, an apprenticeship program, or for that matter, passing the information along to the folks in the shop itself.
Sure. I mean, you probably are aware that many of the, I'd say a lot of our students come in with apprenticeship credits. Many of them are fully accredited the apprenticeship programs today. And they bring those credits to the NLC. I mean, that's really what we're geared for, is to take people who've served in the military, who have work experience, who have apprenticeship credits, and apply those to the bachelor's degree. They have to come with some credits, and that's generally where they come from. So I think you're right, and that those programs and getting people in there are very important. And that's really one of our special, let me just put a look in here for the college. I mean, we're Labor's College. We're started by the AFL-CIO. Our work is challenging, but our process is easy. We make it easy for union members. Those people have been employed for a while and, didn't go to college right away or are interested in it, to come back, we assess, things like apprenticeships, military service, experience, leadership experience, life experience, for college credit. So we can put together a package for people if they go to our website, WNLC.edu. They can, walk through the process there. And that's really what we specialize in, is to really be a service to labor people, union members, and to use those apprenticeship credits to get them on their way to the VA.
Well, let's talk a little bit, Tom, about the NLC itself. The National Labor College has been around for
my
a while. good, because I've heard about it in the past because our business partner, the president of this operation, is an immediate past president of a local and has attended trainings at the Meany Center. And I'd like for folks to know a little bit more about the history of the operation and how it got started and what it's been going forward.
Sure. For about, we're the legacy of the Meany Center. Meany Center's was 30 or 40 years been delivering what we call union skills courses to people. I mean, we still have that. People can come and register in April. We have every month we have different union skills classes, which are important for union members. You know, organizing, grievances, anything that they really to make them more effective union leaders. And those also have college credits. They can apply those to the degree. About 10 years ago, we started offering a BA program. About 5 years ago, we were accredited. We're accredited by Middle States, the same people that accredited Johns Hopkins, accredits us. We're a fully accredited college. And we offer a BA program in a variety of different majors, health and safety, labor education, labor history, union leadership and administration, political economy of labor, labor studies, really programs that are geared for unions and labor people. So we've been doing that for 5 years, and we look forward to doing it, you know, many years into the future.
No, I'm an education geek, Tom, and what you just described to me has me salivating. The economy, the economy issues, the labor history issues. So I assume that someone has to be a member of some union to be admitted to the degree program. How does that work?
You don't have to be a union member. Our tuition rates, if you are a member of the AFL-CIO union, there's one sort of rate of tuition. You can join, there's an affiliate group from the AFL-CIO called Working America. You can join that. I think it's about $10 a year. That's a minimal expense, and that qualifies you for a slightly higher rate of tuition, but still well below our, you know, our rate for non-union. You'd go through our website. We have, you know, rolling admissions. We have three semesters, about 15 weeks every year. We have a fully online program. It's a long name and a simple concept. The long name is called the Bachelor of Technical and Professional Studies, the BTPS. But that's just a kind of complicated way of saying that that's a fully online program. Our regular BA program is geared for people that work. We're basically an online college. Our regular BA program is delivered what we call low residency, or people in higher ed would call it blended learning. Blended learning means you'd spend most of the semester doing your coursework online, and then 1 week of the semester you'd come to campus for a very intensive week of, you know, classes, discussions. We bring in outside speakers. It's really a great time to be on campus. That's the one time our campus here in Silver Spring, Maryland, really feels like a traditional college student or traditional college campus. There's a ton of energy and there's just excitement in the air. That's next week, actually.
Oh, wow.
It's a spring semester degree week.
It's my understanding, Tom, that the campus itself is some, 47 acres or so?
Yeah, right on the Beltway. We're about 12 miles north of Washington, easy to get to from either Baltimore or Washington. It's an amazing place. What makes this place special for me is that we're the crossroads of the labor movement. If you take a class here, whether it's a union skills class or a degree class, and let's say you're from the mine workers, you're going to sit from, you know, somebody who's a government employee, a public employees union from Alaska. You're from West Virginia. There's going to be steel workers there from Pittsburgh. There's going to be electrical workers from Florida. There's going to be people from Oklahoma, all over the country. We attract union members from just about every state and Canada. We get a few students from Canada as well. And that's what I really think that makes the education here special, is that our faculty are experienced union people and qualified, very high qualified labor educators. But you also learn a lot from the students here, because you see people in different industries, different unions, different parts of the country who bring in those experiences and their own questions and experiences to the classroom as well. And I think that's a very valuable thing.
It's interesting you had mentioned the faculty, because that was going to be my next question. Tell us a little bit about the faculty itself.
Sure. A lot of our faculty have PhDs. Many of them have experience as union staff. I myself have I'm a very lucky person, a working class academic. That was very rare for me in graduate school to run across people who were, you know, came from a working class background and still were in a PhD program. I was the last of four kids in a working class family and had an opportunity to go to college. And then I was a farmer and put myself through graduate school by picking tomatoes and running a crew on a big vegetable and fruit farm in upstate New York. A lot of our faculty have similar experiences. They've worked for unions. I myself was a college professor for 12 years, And then I worked for the largest higher ed union. I come out of the tradition of the American Federation of Teachers. We were an affiliate, Local 2190 of AFT. We were the largest higher ed union in the country, representing about 35,000 faculty and professional staff at the State University of New York. I was the education director, legislative director for them for 10 years. So I have one foot in the labor movement, and my other foot's in higher ed. And to be here, to be provost of the National Labor College, about the best I can think of, is the top of the mountain for me.
It sounds like a wonderful, wonderful job. Let me ask you. I know I'm just sort of shifting gears, so I hope I'm not just taking you all over from pillar to post. But
no, not at all.
Tell us a little bit about the Lane Kirkland Center, please.
The Kirkland Center is our new conference center, which is a state-of-the-art building. You know, state-of-the-art classrooms. We have a teleconferencing center. Now we're just looking to try to be able to use that to deliver our courses to union halls around the country. That's putting together a proposal for. You know, smart classrooms, computer centers, our food here is legendary. You know, we want to bring people in and give people a really great experience when they're here, either for the union skills courses or the degree week. And that state-of-the-art building was put together by the bricklayers, by the iron workers. There's the glass was put in by the different affiliates of the AFL-CIO, and it's a tribute to their work. It's just a wonderful facility.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. Let me ask you this then, as we talk about green workplace practices, is being green something that is important to the National Labor College itself?
Absolutely. Not only do we talk the talk, we also walk. We have recycling on campus. We use local farmers to the greatest extent possible for produce. We have a long list of things we do here because that's one of the things that we discussed, very seriously. If we're going to have a green curriculum, we had to, be as green as possible on campus as we are, in our rhetoric. And, we do a lot of that.
Do you have any wind and solar going yet?
We don't, but we're looking at it, geothermal. Also, there's a lot of that around in this area. And that's certainly on the wish list. Let me put it that way.
Well, this is also exciting, Tom, because it really is a glimpse of a future that can be, and as you go forward with it, we will be thinking about you and certainly wishing you the best. Have I missed anything along the way?
I don't think so. I mean, just pitch our website again, www.nlc.edu. I mean, maybe the only thing that I would say that we haven't discussed. April 28th, very important in the labor movement, is Workers' Memorial Day. And we're in the process of constructing a Workers' Memorial. I think it's the only memorial to people killed on the job in the United States. There are benches available. The mine workers, I believe, were the first people to buy a bench. I think they were the first affiliate of the AFL-CIO to contribute and to buy a bench. And we also, people can buy bricks. To commemorate people, to memorialize people who've been killed on the job. And the groundbreaking for that place, this Workers' Memorial Day on April 28th. I think that's a very important part of our campus.
That's very inspiring to hear because it is very easy in the business of coming and going, getting and spending, to take labor for granted. And we often forget, I fear, that there are men and women out there who work in profoundly dangerous circumstances and who sometimes do lose their lives. It is a testament to labor that the number of those people is hopefully decreasing and diminishing over time, but they certainly should not be forgotten. And the fact that y'all have taken the lead at that memorial is, as I said, inspiring, and I just jotted a note down for myself to note April 28th, and perhaps we can talk again about the ceremony that's taking place. Tom Krieger, thank you very much. I appreciate your conversation on this because it is something that we've been talking about a lot, and as the program gets into full swing, I hope we'll hear back from you.
Absolutely, Bob. I really appreciate the time, and I just want to give a little special hello to any of our graduates that are out there in your listening area and all the union folks out there in West Virginia. Think about the labor cause. That's what we're here for.
All right. Tom Krieger, thank you very much, sir. Take care.
All right.
Pleasure talking with you. Bye now.
Bye.
Tom Krieger, provost of the National Labor College, in regard to the Green Workplace Certificate Program recently announced. I was in the room, in fact, when John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, appeared at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference, and I've got some snaps of him. Nick Regalado and I both stood there and watched the announcement. It is extremely exciting, and, well, it's the way forward. It's the future. It's thinking like this that will take us into the future. It's apprenticeship programs and paying attention to green practices, whether it's wind, solar, or some of the things that we may consider to be more prosaic, just considering how the windows are placed in a building to take advantage of passive solar, geothermal. Probably we talk so much about wind and solar, geothermal is often left out of that equation. John Fox would sort of smack me upside the head for it, because you can't overestimate the import of geothermal in this. And labor will be the be-all and end-all of this process, because only organized labor has the momentum and the force to really drive the concept forward. It will be labor advocacy in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures that brings brings about a greening of the economy. It'll be labor that makes the importance of a green economy most cognizable to working Americans. And you can't overestimate what Tom Krieger said about sustainability isn't just about the environment. It's also very much, very, very much about families. And at the end of the day, you can't say enough about the fact that it is good union jobs it's good union jobs that make families able to stay together and able to have the spending money, for instance, because of good wages, to participate in things that might cost a little bit more but do less harm to the environment. So I'm really, really proud and really excited to hear about this program, and I hope we will get some follow up. And the rest of you, do what I did. I know I don't tell you to do things very often, but write down April 28th, put it on your calendar. Note the fact that that is a very special day in terms of remembering the people who have worked and sacrificed to make this all to make this economy go. And I take nothing away from any of the other groups, but you see military memorials, and you see police memorials. And those are memorials to validly offered to people who have laid their lives on the line. But it's all too easy to forget that the people who work with electricity, who work high in the air, whether carpenters or iron workers or any other craft, that they too put their lives on the line, and from time to time, still entirely too frequently, pay the ultimate price. So that's the first hour of the program. You know the phone number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. Direct dial is 304-658-3333. If you want to save us a nickel or a buck, you are welcome to chime in that way. And with all that in mind, I encourage you to learn it, know it, use it. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit about the other component of making America work better, work fairer, and the people who are allied against that effort. This is The Horn.
Follow the Moskwa down to Gorky Park, listening to the wind of change. August summer night, soldiers passing by, listening to the wind of change. We could be so close, like brothers. The future's in the air, can feel it everywhere. I'm blowing with the wind of change.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. General Motors says it won't need to borrow any more money from the government in March because its cost reduction efforts have saved more money than anticipated. The loans are keeping GM and Chrysler afloat as they cope with sharply reduced sales in this recession. GM has requested a total of $30 billion in federal loans to see it through the financial crisis. It has until the end of March to prove to the Obama administration's auto task force that GM is viable. GM had previously asked for $2.6 billion in April and another $4.5 billion in 2010, with access to a credit line of an additional $7.5 billion. The UAW is still negotiating with GM and Chrysler to come to terms over retiree health care and other issues before the two companies report to the auto task force. Bernard Madoff's treacherous crimes have stolen the retirement security of thousands of workers whose unions had millions of dollars in pension funds invested with him. At least 60,000 union workers in New York alone depend on pension funds that were invested with Madoff. In upstate New York, construction unions had at least $354 million invested with Madoff. Plumbers and steamfitters Local 73 in Oswego, New York, for example, was hit very hard, as was Carpenters Local 747. Another state has chosen employee furloughs as a cost reduction measure. Jesse Russell reports.
Alabama is the most recent state to choose employee furloughs as a way to cut a ballooning budget gap. On Wednesday, Alabama's personnel board approved a measure that will allow agencies to furlough employees for up to 24 days per year in order to cut costs. The new rule will go into effect on April 15th, and it is being challenged by the Alabama State Employees Association. The union, representing the majority of state workers, has taken the fight to the legislature's legislative council. And if the council approves the new rules, the union will challenge the state in court. State agencies can only use the furloughs after they have used up other cost-cutting measures, and employees may only be furloughed for a maximum of 2 days per month. Alabama joins a growing list of states choosing or considering employee furloughs to cut costs. Others include California, New Jersey, Georgia, and Hawaii. Here is today's economic report. Even the top hat-wearing and monocle-sporting billionaires of the world are feeling the global recession in their money bins. According to Forbes magazine, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett swapped positions for the top spot, but both lost money this year. Buffett fell to second place on the list and saw his vast fortunes dwindle from $62 billion in 2008 to a mere $37 billion this year. Gates went from $58 billion in 2008 to a scant net worth of $40 billion.
For more labor news, be sure to visit laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, everybody, jump in. The conversation's fine. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on, 304-658-3333. God, if it's not tattooed into your brain by now, I don't know what it takes. And, you know, just a little heads up, I don't know what the hell happened in the last couple of days. Maybe it's stress or whatever, but there's a lot of construction work going on over at the little rural hospital where we took her. And the minute I walked in that place, I felt like somebody turned me upside down and poured concrete in my sinuses. I'm still not up to speed, but if by chance I should start sounding like I'm babbling along in Chaucerian Middle English, just somebody cybernetically tap me on the shoulder and say, Bob, you're having sanity problems, brother. Of course, there are those who would argue that I have those every night, so yeah, there you go. I'm going to go to the phones here just in a second, just following up on the following up on what Tom Krieger was talking about, I want to point a couple of things out to you because there's sleazy and then there's really, really, really sleazy. And this is really, really sleazy. There seems to be no end to the gall, the brass, the shamelessness of the Wall Street banksters. Citigroup, whom you and I, among others,
have given $50 billion. And, you know, like Warren Buffett, who was at 240-some-odd billion and is now down to his last $40 billion, you know, that, you know, when you get up there, you're talking real money, people. But you and I gave Citigroup $50 billion. Well, yesterday, using arguably part of those $50 billion, Citigroup hosted a little phone call. Oh, charming. It was just a little telephone coffee clutch. Citigroup hosted a phone call. Considering the banking mess in this country, why would you host a conference call if you were Citigroup and you just got $50 billion in bailout funds? Maybe you'd host a conference call among all your bank managers, urging them to turn lights off when they're not in the room, or urging them to take affirmative steps to make sure that customers don't run off with the little pens that are chained to the deposit slip table, because that all contributes to the worsening cost structure of Citigroup. Maybe you'd host it. Maybe that's why you'd host a conference call, right? Wrong. Citigroup hosted a conference call. Dadgum, this just chaps my butt! Citigroup hosted a conference call, if you can imagine, to build opposition to the move to provide working men and women in this country with the opportunity to freely choose to join a labor union. No, really. Now, I don't want to have one of those run little Timmy and Cindy out of the room because Uncle Bob's about to use all the fun words moments. But I tell you what, this runs me up pretty close. The Employee Free Choice Act was introduced in Congress day before yesterday. And Citi is out there using those $50 billion that you and I gave them to make sure that working people can't get fair wages or have meaningful health care. Sons of sea cooks! Glenn Spencer is a senior executive at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he, you know, there's a lot of things I guess Glenn Spencer hates in life. You know, he hates stepping on a piece of glass and cutting his foot, you know. He hates having to take the garbage out. He, but there is nothing on earth Glenn Spencer at the United States Chamber of Commerce hates more than the Employee Free Choice Act. The name of the conference call was An Update on the Employee Free Choice Act. Update my Aunt Matilda's left hind foot. What it was a propaganda hit piece on free choice, with the conference call being used to generally just demonize the idea of letting working people check off a little box on a card and thereby say that they would like to be a member of a union. You know, all that's already in the National Labor Relations Act, but you wouldn't know it to listen to these right-wing thugs. Now, according to Glenn Spencer, the Employee Free Choice Act will inhibit flexibility, hamper companies from competing effectively, and prove cumbersome for business. Yes, it'll be cumbersome. From the chamber's perspective, and I would say probably from the whole business community's perspective, there are really no amendments you could make to this bill that would make it acceptable. This is sickening. This is absolutely disgusting. Stephen Lerner is director of the Private Equity Project at the Service Employees International Union. He said, Citigroup and Chamber of Commerce have no shame. One day, Citi issues a report claiming it would hurt the stock of the billionaire Walton family if the free choice passes and workers win decent wages. And then they follow it up with a conference call where the Chamber of Commerce claims paying workers a living wage is bad for the economy. Well, who's going to buy all those confounded Chinese TV sets, huh? I got an email today from our buddy Tom in California. It had photos attached, so you'll just have to trust me on what the photos are. But they were breathtaking. I really am coming to the phone in just a second. Tom wrote and said, I thought you might be interested in these photos, Bob. Tour of a fancy Chevy dealership I passed yesterday. It was just built a couple of years ago, and now there's not a single car there except the one the security guard drove to his shift. Meanwhile, the roll-on, roll-off ships, and we're not talking about deodorant here, have been coming in here in Richmond about once a week and disgorging thousands of new cars. He says the picture doesn't really do it justice. There are at least four times more cars sitting here in the picture than are shown in the picture. Some are loaded onto trains and some on trucks. Don't know how many just sit here, and they're mostly Kias. Who's able to buy these cars? Are they just warehousing them on lots? I'm sorry, I'm no protectionist, but that is offensive to me. And, of course, Kias are, by definition, Korean, I do believe. Somebody correct me if I'm wrong. But we have to continuously prop up the Korean economy, because if the Koreans get real good and pissed off, they might just start not liking us so much. And the next thing you know, that little ceasefire, remember, the Korean War did not end. It's a ceasefire. We are still engaged in a state of hostilities with North Korea. Then that all goes the south. Thanks for the photos, Tom. I really appreciate it. Stunning. Just to see all the... I mean, it's breathtaking to see. But American workers don't deserve to be able to choose straight up whether they want to belong to a union, because it would be bad for business. And, you know, I mentioned a phrase the other night called self-dealing. I want to bring this to your attention. The day before the conference call, Citigroup leveraged, did a little, you know, a little muscle work, okay, the financial equivalent of the brick through the window. Yeah, you know, if you paid us $1,000 a week, you wouldn't be getting bricks through your windows. Citigroup downgraded Walmart's stock ratings from buy to hold. They downgraded that rating based on fears. The daggum EFCA was just introduced yesterday, okay? Just introduced. But with the introduction of the EFCA, Citigroup downgraded Walmart stock from buy to hold, saying that Walmart will suffer if the Employee Free Choice Act is passed. This is disgusting. It ought to be illegal to do that. Because don't think for a minute that every single soul that works at Walmart didn't hear about that. So, did you hear? Citigroup's downgraded our stock from buy to hold. They said that if we can join unions, our stock's worthless. Well, I guess we better not join a union. What the hell's the difference between that and the nasty little things that Walmart does now, where they haul the workers into an office somewhere and sit there and tell them, oh, you'll all be communists if you join a union? They do that. And you, as a Walmart worker, do not have the right, the freedom of assembly or disassembly, to leave the damn thing, because you walk out of the room while they're smearing unions and you're out of a job, buster. How many times have I said that right-wingers and corporatists cannot win in a fair fight? On a level playing field, there is not a single issue in America on which the right wing can win. So they have to cheat, and this is cheating. There's nothing out there, business-wise, to suggest that Walmart's stock is any less valuable because the Employee Free Choice Act was merely introduced in Congress. This is economic thuggery. And you got to wonder if somebody will call them on it. Harry Reid did come out with a statement earlier this week. He said fierce resistance from Republicans and business groups could force him to delay action on the Employee Free Choice Act. Go get him, Harry! Give him hell! Oh, give him heck, Harry. Whew. Mother McCree. Let's go to the phones. Hey, Reverbo, welcome to the program.
God, why do I even want to chime in. You're on a roll, man.
Somebody's got to give me a break.
I was hoping you would, all these observations would prompt you to go into some more of that Syrian old English that we love so much.
Oh, when not a brilliant with a shorter suit.
I was just waiting for it. Oh, God, you know, this really is, these people have more in common with Bernard Madoff than they do with anybody else. I mean, really, Bernard Madoff, they wish they were him. Matter of fact, I guess they are him, and just they just have a larger building, a bigger office than he does. And he got caught, and they didn't.
Right.
Wait a minute. They did get caught, but they got the get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. And yeah. Bernard Madoff, his hands touched $65 billion, Riverbo.
Oh, that's big.
The people sent in to find where the money went have found a billion of it. That's like putting together a plane after a crash. We got the tail set. We found the black box. But, you know, the black box, it at least has the data about what happened to the rest of the plane.
How do these things work? Aren't you always in fear that one of your investors is going to want to cash out at some point?
Well, people did cash out.
Well, you're not gonna be able to cover it.
And he paid it. No, people did cash out, and he paid them with other people's money. This thing went on for 20 years, Riverbo.
Oh, okay. It just sort of self-perpetuates itself like this.
Yeah, but you know, if it was me, if it was me, never mind. But why can't we go back and investigate? Because there's got to be some sort of a record somewhere of who did get cash out and who did get paid. Because remember, Madoff was promising in excess of 10%, like per month or something. You know, if we're talking about, work with me here for a minute, Roberto. If you see me and you're a cop, and you see me walking down the street with a brand new LCD TV under my arm, and you know that I couldn't afford one in a month of Sundays, or maybe I'm pushing it on a dolly and it's one of those 65-inch affairs. And you stop me and you say, "Hey, Bob, where'd you get the TV, buddy?" And I look at you, Officer Riverbo, and I say, "Officer Riverbo, I found it. Guy gave it to me in an alley. Said he didn't need it anymore." "Yeah, but it's still new in the box." "Yeah, well, he said he didn't really want it. He didn't have room for it." At that point in time, you arrest my sorry butt and you throw me in jail. Because a standard applies to the crime of receiving stolen goods, Riverbo, that says you're guilty of receiving stolen property if you knew or should have known. That's the standard. Knew or should have known that the property was stolen. And my ass goes to the pokey for 1 to 10 in West Virginia. Because I got no business with a 65-inch big-screen LCD television, and everybody knows it. So why can that standard not be applied to the people who invested with Bernie Madoff and cashed out and got paid? If you're getting 10% per month in a market that is routinely paying, at best, maybe 8 or 10% if you're a real genius per year, how is it that you're not standing there with a TV under your arms? Does this make sense?
Yeah, and it also always made sense to me that he couldn't have possibly been doing this by himself.
Oh, no, he was definitely not a lone gunman.
No, I mean, you're sort of implicating the people who got out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go after them. 10% per month? I mean, isn't that what they were reporting at one point, that he was hustling a 10% per month Ponzi scheme? I mean, at some point in time, does good old fashioned American wit and wisdom not play into this? You remember that old one? If it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
People, I heard a woman today who was interviewed on NPR. Oh, by the way, this was really funny. Our local public radio station had one of those short breaks where they give a plug to whoever's paying the bills for that hour or that segment, and today's was brought to us by General Motors, who that part of their ad, the ad copy was that they're so green, Bob, and they're into things like.
In 2 years, we'll have a plug-in hybrid that we killed 10 years ago.
Yeah, and their in-cell car. And I was just thinking, hold on a second, I got to go check and see if one of those is in my garage. Wait a minute here. No, it doesn't look like it, but it must be on order, I guess.
Yeah. Today's edition of classical music for insomniacs is brought to you by General Motors, who reminds you, we're going broke! Buy a damn car!
If your stock is, share your stock's like $1.51, I suppose suddenly you're just going to be, you're into hydrogen cell cars or something. I wish I could, and I had some errands to run today, and I would have loved to have just fired up that hydrogen car and picked up George Jetson and gone to the store, but, God, are these people just grasping at straws? What? It's ridiculous. Hey, first of all, I could not just see you walking down the street with that TV because I would be accused of profiling. So that ain't going to go anywhere.
Fat white guy with television? No, we're all over the place. That's not profiling. Now, it would be anachronistic to see me with a television, but that much is true. Maybe I'm tooling down the street with one of those fancy Viking ranges from somewhere down in Mississippi on my cart.
I think that would be great. Just,
guy gave it to me.
Hand truck with all these gigantic toys, and just I don't know. It's funny. I just met this guy in the parking lot, and look what I found. Yeah.
And you know, Cossack in the chat room is pointing out, Reverbo, that where Bernie Madoff's concerned, you had to beg Bernie to get into his scheme. You had to beg. Oh, please, Bernie, come on. I got $52 million here that's just laying around, and it's only doing 8% a year. Please, can't you get me in on your deal? Please, Bernie.
This lady said that she and her husband, when he was talking to them, this was right about the time they invested in about the time that the dot-coms, when things were really zooming, like around 1990, late 90s or all of this, and you know, I suppose you could be some of the profits people were making back then were like, hell, 15, 20, 25, 30%, you know. Before that, the house of cards, you know.
Yeah, went the way of all flesh.
So she was talking about how Madoff was, he seemed to have his whole spiel just down perfectly. He wasn't guaranteeing any more than 10, as if that isn't already just fantastic. And he had, of course, a secret floor through which you couldn't fall. So, you know, it wasn't going to fluctuate too much. And 10 was just great, you know, even in the face of people, you know, conceivably making like 20, you know, investing in, who knows, something like Amazon or something. And then after the whole thing was over, and she said she and her husband essentially just totally believed the guy, just were totally taken in by this, and it seemed so... The funny part is, it just seems so rational, humble, so well thought out. And they asked her, so how are things going now? She goes, well, we had like $1.4 million to invest, and we invested it all, and we lost every penny of it. And now we're kind of wondering what we're going to do.
Well, I mean, that was kind of sobering to hear that Warren Buffett's down from $240 billion to $40.
Yeah, God, he must not too many shrimp on the shrimp cocktail plate tonight.
How do you sleep? You know, because I've liked a lot of the things that Warren Buffett has said over the years. For instance, there's a class war in this country, and trust me, my class is winning. Or pointing out the fact that his secretary pays a higher percentage of her income in income taxes than he does.
Yeah.
But he came out the other day and, you know, just did a stupid. I would have expected him to be better than this. But Warren Buffett came out the other day and said, I got to tell you, I'm against card check. That's what they keep calling this thing, a card check agreement. As if the world, the United States is just going to sprout unions the minute that this thing passes. You know, it's going to defeat the secret ballot in union elections. No, it's not. It's still in the law. It just gives a majority the right to check off the card and say I want to, and that's the end of it.
they don't want anything to, they don't want to equalize anything. They don't want to spread the wealth around. I mean, these people are literally their nose barely above the waterline, and they're still squawking and acting like pricks. I mean, yeah, I guess it is cumbersome. That's a great word for it. Isn't the middle class a cumbersome bunch? Aren't these workers, isn't labor just, they're just so cumbersome. I mean, look at this.
It would be so much easier if we were just serfs.
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here.
You know.
Oh, there you go, yeah. But, I mean, we are. The middle class is just has become so annoying. We want things like basic rights. We want health care. We want a decent standard of living. And the thing that really pisses me off is that we're willing to pay for it if we have the opportunity to play capitalism with you all. That's all.
But we can't play capitalism with them. It's their ball. It's their field. We'll mess up. You know, I mean, where will be the fun of having the ladies with their funny hats and their high heels come on and stomp the divots back into the ground on the polo field, Reverbo, if us hoi polloi are out there doing it? For, I mean, that's one of the few joys the wealthy get in this life.
Man, I'll tell you, if the fix wasn't in, and if they didn't, if it wasn't already, you know, decided that the taxpayers would pay these people, would bail these people out, you would be singing, they'd be singing an entirely different song right now. And that really is, that just kills me. You know, it's just like I made my decision. I made my vote. I've already decided how I feel about this. And then they go ahead and get their money anyway. And that's, you know, that's when the drowning guy is still cussing you out and waiting for you to throw him the life raft. I mean, that's the only time that kind of crap ever happens. And it, I love that guy you had on when you opened the show. I mean, it just contrasts all of this stuff, the us, the we versus me, society.
Oh, look, if there was some way they could do it, don't think for a minute the right wing wouldn't shut down the National Labor College.
Oh, sure they would.
I mean, you can't have working people out there getting all edumacated and stuff. That was bad for America.
It's so sad because, I mean, it's so, and it's also so clear because you've got, on the one hand, you've got this contrast between wealth and prosperity. The contrast, I mean, you would think, you know, to have a nice standard of living for everybody, you want to just bash your head against the wall. No, actually, I want to bash their head against the wall. Because what I want everybody to do is, there's a difference between making the country better and the world better. By the way, y'all want to put your money where your mouth is. The global economy, it's either there or it ain't. So now we're talking about the world.
Right.
But as opposed to just making you better, or making you better by making me poorer. I mean, you know, it's like, it really is an experiment here. The United States is really this interesting thing going on. You know, we try. No, it isn't Canada and Sweden. And it also isn't, I don't know, the Congo or Colombia. We really try to have this balance going on here. And we try really hard to enable the private sector. Do we not?
We do. I mean,
good grief, to the point of where, well, our laws and our legislation simply are for sale. We can go that far.
It might have been you, Reverbo, or someone else on this program. There's so many daggum smart people who call this program that I kind of lose track after a while. But who was it that said a week or so ago, if you want to see the logical extension of laissez-faire free market capitalism, your working model is Somalia?
Sure, yeah.
You know, it's not the United States. It's not some libertarian, anarcho-Randian, but wait a minute. The libertarian, anarcho-Randian paradise is Somalia. I mean, don't the strong survive and eat the weak in Somalia? Isn't the market just whatever, the economy's whatever the market will bear? Law doesn't get in the way of business. Isn't that Somalia?
Oh, like where the pirates are.
Yeah.
So the government by piracy. Yeah. But, I mean, it's all, I don't know what you make of it here when you, you know, you walk down the halls of of Congress, and people have signs outside their offices, says bribes accepted between 8 and 5. I mean, good Lord, we bend over backwards here for the private sector. And, but, you know, then it's when they put the, when they put, you know, profit on the cross, they take the baby Jesus down and put profit on there, and then it's what you
do. Yeah, that's holy profit with an F and an I and a T. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think that reading about and following all this right-wing BS for Verbo is bad for me because of just what where it takes my poor little brain. You talk about me, I talked about babbling along in middle Chaucerian Middle English. This is how bad it is. Now, like I said, I'm a little funny in the head right now. I'm not all home. So I ran down when we got Ferg back from the hospital today, and thanks for your good wishes, by the way. When we got Ferg back from the hospital today, my next job was to go down to the pharmacy and fill his pain meds. So I did. Now, well, you'll have to wait 45 minutes. Well, okay. So I do, and I ran up and got a couple of tomatoes at the grocery store. Anything, you know, eesh, I hate killing time. But I'm on the way back, and we have this wonderful hardware store where I do business with Herbo. You know, the oily old floors, and they creak. And, you know, if you look at the proprietor and say, you know, I need a screw this long, by this, and he goes, oh, they're right over there. Come here. You want a dozen? You know, not like going to Lowe's or the Home Despot or anything.
I remember.
So when you to get to this place, the road, the main road is so-called New U.S. 60, and the old road is Old U.S. 60, and it was a winding snake's back of a thing, and only little chunks of it survive now, kind of like Route 66. But they've got a sign for the local hardware store that sits at the juncture of Old 60 and New 60 for the Southern States Cooperative that they run, and it says... And, you know, it's spring, and this is a rural community, so it makes sense that they would have this up there. It says, order chicks now. Well, I drove home, opened the door, and looked at Agnes and said, get me a beer. I'm not, because, you know, that's what order chicks now means to a right-winger. Why aren't you pregnant? Get me a beer. Flatten your head. Yeah. I'm sorry, that was way off topic, but...
No, it's good. It's good. A sign like that can inspire a whole lot of reaction, that's for sure. Oh, God.
Although, but, truth be told, I'd love to build a little mobile chicken coop. You know, there's plans where you can do that on the back of an old truck bed. You build the chicken coop and you take it around your yard so that the chickens do naturally with the fertilizer thing all over the yard instead of just in one place. And I'd love to buy a bunch of chickens and raise them for eating and raise them for eggs and take one little bite out of the commercial consumer cycle. If I could do that, Reverbo, I would feel so darn good.
God, I'm dreaming about the idea of getting some chickens and putting them in the back of a pickup truck somehow and cutting holes in the floor and driving them around your yard or around your garden in this sort of automatic fertilization concept. I guess only where you live can you dream up such a stunt like this.
You know, it's just my happy little acre. Yeah, but coming up with fun stuff to do on that little acre, bliss.
I remember buying chicken poop and bags to fertilize my yard back in Colorado.
Sure. There's nothing better.
Vulture poop? No, it was good. All natural, that's for sure.
Well, the one thing you do have to do is, you know, you can't have it all in one place or you really do. I mean, that's just almost pure solid nitrogen, and it will burn the hell out of your ground. I mean, it'll burn up seeds in the ground. But I have real hopes for what's going to happen this spring. My son-in-law brought home one of those little garden mantis, garden weasel, little tiny tiller things. And I'm hoping him and I are going to get out and turn a little dirt and get some onion sets and some lettuce into the ground. Yum, yum.
Garden weasel. Oh, man, this is bringing back some memories, yeah.
Yeah, it's not quite up there with Popeil's pocket fisherman, but right.
Popeil is making a comeback.
Yes, it is.
He's all over the radio now. He's got some British guy doing commercials for him. The guy, you hear him go, chop tomatoes. And, yeah, I'm just howling at this.
Everything old is new again.
You were talking about the using the bailout money to, you know, have a meeting to fight the labor unions. And, well, you know, the problem is that that's why our country's great, and that's why our country's so frustrating at the same time. That's all you can say. I mean, we are free to say and do what we want for the most part, and that includes being free to be stupid. And I don't know, you just have to tolerate it. It is appalling the gall it would take to do something like that. Well, no more so than going out with the money and buying a new jet.
And right, and that's one of the issues that sort of resonates, Reverbo, around the idea of freedom. Freedom to be stupid. Freedom to be a moron. I ask you philosophically, does one enjoy the freedom to be a liar?
Well, now you're getting into that dicey legal stuff. I got to get a shirt that says free to be stupid. yeah, that's why it's called fraud, I suppose.
Well, then, I mean, and that presupposes people willing enough to believe the lies, but I was talking with Boss Man Wayne earlier today, updating him on Ferg and stuff, and he was telling me about this little meeting that he was going to. And he was going, it's one of those 23rd Psalm things, you know, thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies, my cup runneth over. That, you know, that means, wow, God, you've gotten me into a real mess this time. But Wayne was going to go talk to a bunch of right-wingers about the Employee Free Choice Act, and I haven't heard back, but he told me his plan of attack was to look at these weasels and say, listen, we can have an honest dialogue about the Employee Free Choice Act, or you can keep lying. Because you're telling lies about the Employee Free Choice Act. If you want to have a legitimate political, social, economic debate about its merits or lack of merit, that's fine. But as long as you're lying about it, all I can do is sit there and say, you're a liar. And I mean, I got an example of it here. Of course, it comes from Fox.
Of course.
Bill Hemmer, soon Americans who want to say no to unions might not be able to vote in private. And then, of course, the Papa Bear Bill O'Reilly. Union officials have an open invitation to appear here on The Factor. They won't because their arguments for socialism won't stand up. No, maybe labor leaders and proponents of employee free choice, Reverbo, refuse to appear on Bill O'Reilly because when you lay down with dogs, you get up with fleas. And then there's Martha McCallum. This is going to make it very tough for small business to function. They might have to lay people off. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Fear. It's what's for dinner, you know?
Well, and then demonizing it with that ridiculous socialist tag. And it just goes back to what I was trying to talk about before, how, Lord, we try to bend over backwards to try to help these people, to try to enable them. They became rich beyond 100 lifetimes for me and you because they were here, and we let them do that. We allowed them to do that.
We paid our taxes. We maintained a military. We built an infrastructure, all of which, you know, corporate America benefits a hell of a lot more from railroads, from the regulations surrounding railroads, from the building of highways, public water systems, all of that. The corporate America benefits manifestly more from that than the ordinary citizenry do. But we pay most of the money for it.
That's right. That's right.
But, you know, if we say that we want to enjoy some of the benefits too, communist, you don't love Jesus in America anymore.
Well, I guess if you can't have 100% of it, what did Wilson Pickett say? 99.5% just won't do.
Yeah, there you go.
It's amazing. I should send that song to you. I may have to do that.
Oh, I think you should. I mean, if my opinion is valid in this discussion.
Wilson Pickett can get you take your mind off of the economy in a hurry.
Yeah, take your mind where your mind ought to be.
May he rest in peace, too. It's what you need, of course, is a national vision. And hopefully we have that now. I'm all for enabling people. I'm all for capitalism, man. I'm all for all of this stuff. But just don't make yourself, you know, rich by making me beg.
See, I could pass. We could pass fun little laws out there, Reverbo. I'd like to pass a law.
Green socks on Thursdays, and you have to wear a hat on Saturday.
Right. And thereby we would stimulate the hat-making industry and put people to work. Absolutely. And the green sock-making industry. But any, no.
I mean, it wouldn't be a felony if you didn't have a hat on, but there would be a price to pay, probably an hour or two picking up trash by the side of the road.
Right, and I want a law that says if you are a right-winger, you cannot mention capitalism in any form of broadcast until and unless you present certification that you have read and passed a test that you comprehend Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations. I mean, is it... Because again, it goes back to my inquiry, Reverbo. Is there within the social and political and economic and governmental structure of this country, is there a freedom to be a liar?
I'm afraid there is. I'm afraid there is. But there's also, you got to remember, it's that analogy of the, you know, there's 50 people on the bus and 40... Nine of them are sitting there quietly reading the paper, and the one is running his mouth off as loud as he can, you know, in front, and he's getting all the press. You know, the fact is that the statistics right now, the American people are totally behind Obama. The American people are totally for the for labor. The American people are totally, you know, they're not. Everything's going along well. You see what I'm getting at here?
Yes.
Like you said, maybe you should stop, you know, spending so much time listening to what the right wing has to say. Well, just let's not forget that at the moment, all they got is talk. The statistics just do not support their position.
Yeah. Well, I want to share. I mentioned Adam Smith for a reason, Reverbo. Our buddy Rory with the Coal River Wind Project. You know, people use these little quotes down for their signatures down at the end of their emails. And I saw Rory's email signature the other day, and I thought, wow, I got to write that down. Because what do you think Bill O'Reilly would say, or Hannity, or Flemball, or any right-wing member of, you know, Mitch McConnell, Mike Pence, any of those weird-ass little thugs in Congress, what do you think they would say if you presented them the following quote from Adam Smith, you know, Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith?
Sure.
The progressive state is in reality the cheerful and the hearty state to all the different orders of the society. The stationary is dull, the declining melancholy. Ain't that a beaut?
What an inspiring observation that is.
Because, you know, you can replace progressive with liberal. The liberal state is in reality the cheerful and the hearty state to all the different orders of the society. The stationary is dull, the declining melancholy.
You can replace it with a word like even fair or balanced or I love it. What did they say? What do most four-year-olds say?
Well, you're taking Adam Smith out of context. By progressive, he meant conservative.
Right. This just sounds like another socialist agenda to me. Oh, God. Well, all they're doing, the overwhelmingly people want to go in a direction. So we didn't get a chance to talk about this very scary business with the CIA, which really is nothing new, I guess.
And with the what's it called? J. Sock, J. Rock, no, that's my senator. J. Sock, Joint Special Operations Command.
That's it.
It really is. I'm not wrong on this, am I, Reverbo? That's a fancy name for Murder Incorporated, right?
Pretty much. Here we go. Let's just hit. Start your search engines with Paul Wellstone, Ken Lay, Mike Connell, the whole crowd.
And they reported?
But there's nothing new to me. I don't know. It's just, and Seymour Hersh didn't really go into too much detail. And I mean, but we've heard these stories for years, and I believe every one of them.
Anthrax?
Yeah, what about that? Just to Daschle and Leahy, too.
Yeah.
Just those two.
Meanwhile, the memo quietly goes out to John Ashcroft to stop flying the public transport.
Yeah, I don't look. People that think Americans are very idealistic, and it retards us, I think, at some point, because there are people that still just cannot believe that the powers that be will use things like political assassination and intimidation and.
Yeah, and just not to put too fine a point on it, but to make people understand, to help people understand what it is we're talking about, this is a quote from Seymour Hersh at a forum at the University of Minnesota. He said, right now today, there was a story, and this is a couple of days ago, right now today, there was a story in the New York Times that, if you read it carefully, mentioned something known as the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC it's called. It is a special wing of our special operations community that is set up to independently. They do not report to anybody except in the Bush-Cheney days. They reported directly to the Cheney office. They did not report to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or to Mr. Gates, the Secretary of Defense. They reported directly to Cheney. Congress has no oversight of it. It's an executive assassination ring, essentially, and it's been going on and on and on. Just today in the Times, there was a story that its leader, a three-star admiral named William H. McRaven, ordered a stop to it because there were so many collateral deaths.
Collateral deaths.
Under President Bush's authority, they've been going into countries, not talking to the ambassador or the CIA station chief, and finding people on a list and executing them and leaving. That's been going on in the name of all of us. I don't know about you, Reverbo, but I read that kind of thing, and I get a chill down my spine.
Oh, yeah. This is you can't make this stuff up. This is
that little house called General Rommel. You know what I mean?
You come with us, we leave the wife and children alone. You don't come with us, you take the wife and children with you. You come with us, you blow your brains out, you get a nice hero's funeral.
Can't decide if we're going to put down... shot while trying to escape or committed suicide.
Yep, right there, that wonderful line from Casablanca.
This is nothing new to people who have, lived through, say, the Vietnam era. The CIA went in and killed those two brothers. What the hell were their names?
The Dulleses. The Dulleses.
Yeah, I mean, these kind of, we'll call them monkey shines, have been going on all the time. It's just the CIA is not supposed to be spying on the domestic. The FBI is supposed to spy on us, not the CIA.
You know, that's the first thing. Wait a minute, what's the CIA doing spying on us? That's the FBI's job. Well, and because I know that there was somebody at the FBI going, oh, sorry, sons of Black Stag and Nutpole Frenzel Black, and we're supposed to be. Hey, wait a minute, they're spying on us too.
Yeah.
Bring me my dossier on the CIA. Oh, sir, we don't have one. The guy turned out to be CIA.
This is, people should be, it's almost like, how much more do you need to see people?
Well, do you remember, Reverbo, when they passed the Patriot Act, without bothering to read it, and they said, well, you know, one of the problems we have is that the CIA can't talk to the FBI, and that's why we got hit on September 11th. Exactly. Well, now the CIA can talk to the FBI. The FBI can talk to the CIA. And it doesn't seem to be working out too well. Just saying.
It doesn't seem to be working out very well. But what do you call this? Used to be known as the black ops, right? And they have their black budget. And this is all like the shadow government. This is all, and you're not responsible to, the classic way things work is you're responsible to you and me. We pay your salaries.
But, oh, wow. You know, I got to tell you, Reverbo, you just did something for me. I'm gonna when John gets back online after the big move, we got to work on a parody. I just did the Black Ops to the tune of the John Mellencamp's Pink Houses.
Yeah, I can't. If it's anywhere.
There's an agent in the basement listening to my conversation. It just happens. God, you're good.
Well, no. If it's anywhere near how good your lyrics were to Take Me Home Country Roads parody, I'm sure we all cannot wait to hear this.
Well, I may have a little toddy after the show tonight and come up with those lyrics and send them along to John for later, because That could be fun. Hey, Reverbo, I'm going to run on, brother, but as usual, you bring a bunch to the table, and I love the conversation.
Well, great. I enjoyed talking to you. Make it personal, as usual, and we'll catch up with you down the road.
All right. Take care, Reverbo.
Okay, bye now. Bob. Bye.
Critic at large, Reverbo. And we'll keep things rolling along. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, Bob.
David.
Icy Middle Tennessee.
Is that coming my way? No, actually, I think it's already here.
I haven't looked at the weather. I've spent enough time considering weather earlier in the day, and I just, you know, I'm taking the evening off. But my first topic is numerology. 36-34.
Okay.
Who's got it? West Virginia or Pitt?
At this point, I'd say probably WVU.
You're up two at the half.
Stunning. Won't last, but stunning. But this is, you know, this is a season
you're
when
of little faith.
Oh, no, I am not of little faith. I am a Mountaineer fan. I am a realist. Now stop that.
Well, the other reason I called is, my Lord, good grief, Wilson Pickett came up. So it's time for something completely different, trivia question.
Okie doke.
Let's go someplace else for a minute. What do Wilson Pickett, Jackie Wilson, Professor Longhair, and there's one other, but we'll just leave it at those three. What do Wilson Pickett, Jackie Wilson, and Professor Longhair have in common?
Record label?
Nope.
That's too easy.
Before they made it as working musicians, they were prize fighters.
Wow.
Every single one of them made money boxers. If you ever see a full body shot of Wilson Pickett, look at his hand. He's got a hand that belongs on a man 6'4". I mean, it must have been like a mallet coming your way if he ever got it to you. And chances are,
and he played in places from time to time that could have come in quite handy.
Probably he had as much experience learning to defend himself with a rolled up fist as he did singing. The other one was James Brown. He also fought professionally.
I'll be damned. I had no idea.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. Now we've got a little piece of media trivia that I don't think is going to bubble up to the surface, but God, it should. And maybe those Colbert, maybe one of those Marr, maybe one of those Stewart researchers, maybe they saw it like I saw it, and maybe in just a little while this thing will pop up, and it'll be like a big zip, you know, hitting the bathroom mirror.
God!
Well, you'll know why I said that.
Reality radio, this is.
Glorp. What's his name? Oh, yeah, stud muffin hockey player Levi and Bristol.
Yeah, they're not getting along so good, are they?
And now it's not working out so well. There's not even sheets to split yet. It's just like, no, bitch, see you later. Okay, fine. You know,
yeah, I'm back to my original Facebook statement. I don't want no kids.
Exact. Okay. 8-9 days ago, in response to the woman that had a lot of babies, and in response to a couple of other things, a man that I really, really, really detest, I would figure out a way. If I was faced with that god-awful thing where you've still got your brains and enough of your body that you have a few months left and you're making a bucket list. Short in Bill O'Reilly's career.
Tenure on the planet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It would be one of my... It would be right up there. And he blurted out on air, and I saw it on things as a part of something else. He blurted out, but listeners, and I will not do my imitation of Keith Olbermann imitating the guy, he said, but listeners, you need to understand that Sarah and Levi are good kids. They come from good parents, and after the birth of the child, they married. He said on air, and it's on tape, and I've seen it a couple of places as part of another rant of his, he stated flatly that they had married. And I'm thinking, wait a second, I didn't get that memo. Not that I would, but I...
Yeah, let alone the invitation.
You can forget the living daylights out of that one. But I just thought, wait a second, even Mom Sarah had said, you know, Holy Mother Sarah had said, well, they're talking about a summer wedding. Well, you know, most of the time in my part of the world and in my era, if you knew it was on the way, you got married before. So you could, like, backdate the wedding and, you know, not...
And tell, yeah, you were, yeah, tell, yeah, honey, you were premature.
Well, no, you wouldn't even do that. You would, you know, if you were married in May, you would talk about that, how cold it was the day you got married in February. But anyway... O'Reilly said, and it was recorded, and I saw it, among other places, Crooks and Liars, and Sarah and Levi are great kids from a great heritage. They did the right thing, and they are married. Oops. Well, not only are they not married, they ain't going to fix it later. And I'm just hoping that some researcher with, you know, it was just by blind luck that I happened to be watching that swollen-headed asshole say that, because there's not too much of him that I can take in too long a dose. I heard him say that, and it was like, wait a second. I'm questioning, and then I went on to other things, and then nobody else called him on it. Well, now the ante's up just a bit. Now that not only did he make a really big factual error, there's no way for it to get made right later. And it is a bigger topic. You know, here we go. The people that are forever claiming they're the ones with morality. They're the ones with values. They're the ones with all this other stuff. This was just kids being hot, either with a room or in the backseat of a car. And they're no different. They're no better, but they're lying about it.
There you go. Or a snowmobile.
Oh, geez.
Don't want to think about the gymnastics involved, but come on, it could happen.
Well, I just, you know, I might have a level of appreciation for Levi if he could do that on a snowmobile. Snow machines are in season. Gee, many Christmas. There are parts of me that disappear completely in snowmobile weather, but, you know, let's not go there for very much longer.
Okay, I'll be fair and leave that alone, but I couldn't resist. You know, and then again, had the wedding invitations gone out, David, they would have gone out on little cubes of crack.
Oh, yeah.
Or on the back of a dummied up script pad for OxyContin. Yeah, I mean, it's Wasilla. You know, forget about it, Jake. It's Wasilla.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that the script drug capital of that part of the world?
It's the every drug problem in Alaska, capital of Alaska. I mean, remember, was it Levi's mama or grandma that got popped?
His mom.
Yeah, for the Rush Limbaugh problem.
Yes, it was Levi's mother.
And now, now apparently there is, I don't know if you caught this part of it. I saw it when I was doing my daily roll by BartCop.com. But there is trouble in paradise in the Levi, Sarah, the Bristol, the Trip Keyshawn, Flapjack Johnson camp. I still love that. That's the funniest. That's the funniest damn thing Bart Cop has ever published. Trip Keyshawn, Flapjack Johnson.
The poor little guy. You reckon they'll do visitation with like snowmobiles and all the rest? Okay, bad joke.
No, but it turns out they're not doing so good, because I guess Levi's auntie is now brooding it out and about out there. that Bristol won't let Levi see little Flapjack? I'm sorry, I'm up-speaking here.
I think I heard something about that, but that now sounds to me, because I heard that several days ago, too, and that, to me, sounds like his side of the family griping about her when they were breaking up. So I think all of that's just smokescreen. I think the important part is it's so well established now that their history and, you know, Flapjack and Bristol are going to be at the governor's mansion for the foreseeable future.
I mean, because remember, we're talking about uber Christians here, right?
Okay.
And granted, they're fundies and stuff like that, but even fundies, they don't do the baptizing, you know, right after birth kind of thing, but they have a consecrating ceremony. And you come up and you bring your little newborn up, because, you know, fundies have to have something to rival the majesty and pageantry of the Roman Catholic Church, and, you know, babies are too little for diddling, so, oh, God, I'm just awful. You started it with the zit thing. Honest to God, you did. But they
no, wait just a darn minute. I created a bad metaphor about, you know.
And you made a bad host out of me. You made a very bad host out of me.
A tough situation, and you shift over to Purian Enterprise regarding tiny babies. You know, come on now. That's a stretch even for a brain as big as yours.
Or as small. I tell you, I ain't right tonight, David. But seriously, fundies have a consecrating to Jesus thing. And you put some real finery on with a matching fuzzy blanket and everything, and you bring a baby up to the church, and they, you know, the fundamentalist speaks in tongues and dribbles some strychnine on the baby and stuff like that. Where are the photos from that? I mean, I grew up in the Southern Baptist, and you have photos of that, and you're proud of it. Look, we done consecrated the baby to Jesus. Where are the photos of little Trip Keyshawn Flapjack Johnston?
So far, none of that's come around yet.
No. Frankly, you know, where are the birth, you know, the proud papa and proud mama birth photos? You know, when the baby's sitting there being propped up in front of the camera, looking like it's just been shot out of a small bore cannon. Where's that photograph?
You know what? Your prurient interests have triggered something in me. It's 2012. The Republicans are working at it, and I have to do this. I've thought of it. I can't resist.
I earned it.
It's Newt and it's Sarah. Who's on top?
Ooh. It's gonna be a while getting over that.
I'm sorry. I'm proud of that.
I got a bottle of decent tequila that's been laying around here for about 3 years, and I'm feeling kind of toddy-ish after the show. And I've been sort of 50-50. Now I'm going for it.
You have a purpose.
I do. Piyush is still in the mix too, isn't he? It's a three-way.
Look. I will tell you straight, I think he was put up to do that and do that that badly to let the Republicans clear the air and knock down a straw horse, knock down a red herring. He was not, could not, will not ever be. There will never be a minority that will matter to the Republican Party. They put him up there to draw some attention and be knocked down by the nation, and the nation will be relabeled in their mind as the evil media. Such triumphant Sarah, triumphant Newt, whoever's the top, whoever's the bottom, will then come along later to try to, you know, pull their base, that 20% of America, barely, maybe, that would fall for that. Today, on a very long drive, you know, with plenty of time to pay attention, I saw a woman in her probably mid-40s, and she had two bumper stickers on a badly cared for SUV. Have you ever seen one of these no bomber?
Oh, more than I saw my first one last June when I pulled up.
It's a very special one. It was a black oval with a no bomber in blue, but above it was a white flag.
That I haven't seen.
Black oval. And next to it was, of course, a McCain sticker. And I just thought, my gosh, how can these people be so stupid and so bigoted and so ignorant and wishing that that pea-brained woman that, well, not...
Well, did Piyush Jindal actually succeed? Okay.
I shouldn't say woman as if that's a condemnation. It's not. That pea-brained person, you know, how could anybody not see through what Sarah was saying and doing and offering? And now we're back to, what's his name, Piyush?
Yeah, Piyush. And my only question is, okay, you've said that was a set piece. Was the set piece designed to make Sarah Palin look, you know, Godzilla from Wasilla? Was it made to make her look smart?
I believe it was. That guy has degrees from places that matter. He has studied and excelled. I've seen him speak in soundbite clips before. He was never that inarticulate, that stupid, that out of his element, that clumsy. He said things that I firmly believe he knew were absolutely dead wrong.
Well, he was lying outright about the conversation with the sheriff about the rowboats.
Well, that and various, I've forgotten the details of what he was doing, but I really believe he was put up there to fall over. And I think he was told, look, you do this now, you're a very young man, you know, 20 years down the road, you'll be recycled, rebranded, you know, you'll go through the cosmic brain shift.
Oh, my God. They're stealing the model, David. Bill Clinton, in 1988, stood up in Atlanta, I was there, and delivered the worst political speech of all time. 4 years later, he was his party's nominee.
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, that's just queasy. That's creepy. But the thing is, no, I'd say Newt's on, to answer your previous question, Newt's on top right now.
Ew.
For the simple reason that he is the one who has stood up and said that Limbaugh is batshit crazy. And that gives him a, because, you know, the Flush Limbaugh's numbers are somewhere between the sink and the toilet with the general American public. And now now he's got Flimball out there calling him names. Well, I think Newt understands Flimball's business better than Flimball understands Flimball's business. And he's just and Newt, you know, I know, David. Newt is, it really is. He's crazy. He's crazier than a sprayed roach. But by coming out and saying that Flimball is nasty, suddenly he appears reasonable.
He is another straw horse. He is a fake entity to pull people that don't want to understand that there is nothing good about the Republican Party for the long-term health of our nation or its citizenry, unless you're the top 3% of the earners. There is nothing good in the Republican Party for the balance of the nation and the nation itself. Newt is saying that to pull the unwary back into the fold. And Limbaugh's an egomaniacal drug addict that really thinks he's got a lot of things going for
Oh, that jiggle fest that he did at CPAC while I was in D.C. Did you see pieces of that?
That was creepy. That man probably actually believes he's good in bed.
Oh, now see, you're just working him tonight.
Take that anywhere you want. That man has outkicked his recovery so badly this time.
Oh, it's a line drive punt. They'll never get down there in time.
Wait a second. That fellow that can run really fast and has a great two-step slide step to his right has just shed the third tackler.
Yeah.
This could be bad for the home team.
God. Oh, please, listen. Please, somebody. Please, God, if you're up there, yeah, let Flimball get caught with another cigar box full of pills. Because you know he is. We've got all this. There are liberals out there, David, that have enough money to burn a wet elephant. Why isn't anybody putting a tail on Rush for his little boys-only trips to the Dominican Republic? Because, you know, boys-only trips to the heart of the child sex trade, they really are like Lay's potato chips. You can't only go one time.
I don't understand why we don't do that. I really don't, because Lord knows they have worked so hard, all right, fine. That Democrat from North Carolina that I used to think so much of, he declared an indiscretion. Pales in comparison to what some of the Republicans have done. I mean, for every five of theirs, there's one of ours. And to them, they think they've carried the day by reminding everybody that Teddy Kennedy has a situation that's now 40 years old. They really think they've won it. They can turn Rush Limbaugh into St. Francis by saying the words Teddy Kennedy.
Oh, and speaking of Republican indiscretions, you're reminding me of some of the stuff that I didn't get to because I had to bug out last night. But I was sitting there looking at a headline last night. Vitter went ballistic on an airline worker, then fled the scene before security arrived. Did you run across this one, David?
That's one of the most delicious things going. Yes, he did the short version. In his mind, oh, gee whiz, oh, yeah, he's another one of those legends in his own mind. He did the don't you know who I am routine with some folks. He got to a flight. The flight had closed. You know, the gate was closed. And he just decided, well, yeah, you've closed it for all those other people that bought first-class tickets, but I am Senator Vitter. So I'll just push this thing aside, and I'll just go walk on the plane because I'm who I am. Oh, I'm late. I've screwed up your entire process. Doesn't matter. Don't you know who I am? So, yes, I'm very well aware of that. Sadly, there's no video, but there is an FAA investigation underway as to what he did to personnel at FedGate.
And, of course, his response, I did have a conversation with an airline employee, but it was certainly not like his silly gossip column made it out to be.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
You know, there. Honest to God, when you are a Southern man and you use the word silly, I'm not picking on anybody, but under those circumstances, there's more than a little smattering of Scarlett O'Hara in there, isn't there? It was certainly not like this silly gossip column made it out to be. I'll worry about it tomorrow.
I remember a certain large-nosed Southern elected official. Oh, the guy had a nose like a rudder on a boat. I mean,
you'd like to have a nose like that full of nickels, wouldn't you?
Well, I guess. No, Ms. Fox is a fine stage artist. Fanny Fox has no resemblance to the person she's been portrayed in the silly media.
The silly media. Oh, yes, Wilbur Mills.
Yeah, right after.
Gone but not forgotten.
Right after he fell in the pond and showed his heels and his ass to the nation. That was a great night.
But I love the fact that after this confrontation goes down, when the TSA employee And, you know, I just make, I've been in Dulles, okay? I make it a point not to anger any of those people. It's Dulles. You can be on your way to Cuba thinking that you're flying home to Scranton before you know it.
Dulles, all those guys are overworked. It just, you have to, I've done a little flying. I've been to plenty of airports. When you're in Dulles, in that situation, you just automatically assume that anybody in one of those uniforms is late on a car payment, constipated, horny, and has 2 hours of overtime they may or may not get paid for. Just don't do anything other than be a nice guy.
Smile. Do what they tell you. So the TSA person goes off to find a security guard, and Vitter boogies.
Yes, he did.
He scampered. He scampered off. Bravely bold Sir Robin reported. Yeah. Oh, God. The TSA, you're right, does say that they're going to be reviewing the incident. But you're right. You know, there's five of theirs for every one of ours. But the concern of the day is something relating to John Edwards? Hello?
He gave a speech somewhere, and he didn't, you know, fall on his knees and beg the nation for forgiveness. I guess it's the part of the gist of the right wing.
Okay, one last thing I got to bring up with you, because you Southern man that you are, are uniquely qualified to comment on this.
Well, not uniquely, but certainly as Southern, I qualify.
Right. Well, you're as uniquely as anybody on hold right now.
Okay. All right.
This thing in South Alabama. You know, it's hard to talk about any of these things, David. And for me, my only point in this is to point out that it's, you know, just another down payment on our deal with the devil over firearms. And you're a firearm owner. I'm a firearm owner. But I recognize the cost that this nation pays from them. But I'm damned if I can understand. It's so heartrending to begin with. I'm damned if I can understand somebody who gives a quote to the media saying, well, I'm alive because Jesus loves me. I saw that, David. I saw that.
Oh, I was, and remain barely aware of that situation. But you and I share a skepticism and agnostic viewpoint about religion that you know, that someone saying that scares me.
I mean, I know that, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, and the media scampers down there. It's not that far from CNN's home base anyway.
Oh, well, yeah, a guy leaves home with 200 rounds of ammunition and goes through two counties. That's the issue. That's the incident we're talking about, right?
Yes.
Yes.
It's the deadliest crime in Alabama history.
Oh, yike.
And you know, here's the follow-up story saying, in the aftermath of the rampage, among those seeking comfort at First Baptist Church was Josh Matthews. He was driving down the street around the time of the shootings. Could have been anyone. Just missed the gunfire. Could have been any of us, Matthews said. He found out one of his friends was a victim. It'll be hard to move on, he said, but you have to. He was like the happiest dude in the world. He would have wanted us to move on and me to remember him for who he was. And I don't know how a community deals with something like this. And I'm not going to be an ass and say some of the things that could be said.
Well, maybe I will.
But I guarantee you, in that community, the one thing that is anathema is to query the gun issue. But I don't know how you do, David, because if that guy had walked, you know, ex-cop, right, team leader at the local sausage factory.
But with emotional issues, as reported by fellow employees.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Walks out, if he'd walked out of his house with a ball bat or with the martial arts throwing stars or Roman short swords in each hand. Brass knuckles.
In a very extreme situation, there might be two people dead, and there would be, all right, fine, there'd be a bucket load of stitches and hematomas, and that would be that.
See, because I want to find a right-wing gun owner and say, let me see if I got this straight. You've got 12 bolt-action hunting rifles ranging from .222 to 300 mag in your gun safe. You can take down anything from a woodchuck to a grizzly bear. And you're keeping those there in case the government decides to infringe on your rights.
And to prove that your rights aren't impinged upon, you to own something resembling what a functioning squad of 15 soldiers would have to go and fight on a battlefield.
Right.
That's lunacy. I'm sorry.
I mean, this is not...
Please. I have one handgun that I have in case, in that one in a million shot, I wake up and I can find it, and there's somebody that I can see in the middle of the night within my house, and I can pull off two and, first of all, be deaf for 2 or 3 hours by discharging a pistol within my own house and stop that person from hurting me. I have that, and I have a round for that gun, for that five-shot revolver, that is designed to do something short range to a person and not go through three walls and kill somebody a half a block away. But the other side of this, and I'm going to be very vernacular and vulgar about it, that fellow that did that routine about we need to remember him and move on, I'm sorry. That is an absolutely disgusting version of shoulder shrugging, well, shit happens.
God's will.
Yes, he's dead, but oh golly, you know, stuff just happens. That is insane.
Well, when do we have an honest conversation?
In a generation, but somewhere that has to stop. Somebody has to go, no, damn it. He had enough weaponry to bring down, you know, part of a South American revolution.
Yeah.
Just as you said, if he leaves home with one good knife and one baseball bat, it's not going to take very long to bring that to an end.
I mean, I think about those heroes at the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Knoxville.
That's heroes with a big H.
Yeah. That right-wing asshole, went into that church aiming to commit suicide by cop and kill a bunch of liberals. And he expected that them being lily-livered liberals like Sean and Billo had told him that they'd just stand there and get shot and sing Kumbaya. That guy had a sawed-off shotgun and got stopped. But somewhere along the way, David, this conversation has got to take place. Somebody has got to explain, and I use this phrase, as I said, advisedly being one, we got to have a conversation with Scots, Irish, redneck America, and we got to explain to them that it ain't the 18th century anymore, and you're not standing by the rifle slit in the cabin saying, Ma, hand me the 7mm Swift, the barrel on my .30-06 done got too hot, while you're picking off the Indians riding around.
Precisely. It's a whole different situation. Fine, if somebody wants me to register, you know, I walked in a used gun shop in my little town, and he did an online check, and it's a very dodgy check, and I left there with that gun that day. And very frankly, I was a little bit alarmed that I could just walk in there, and because nothing cropped up, I could leave there with a gun. I thought, wait a second, I thought these things were supposed to be checked out. Well, I did. I followed the state law.
Son, are you crazy?
No.
You ever been convicted of a felony?
No.
Promise you're telling the truth?
Yep, here's your gun.
It was barely above that. All right, fine. If somewhere in a statewide database they wanted to know that David in Middle Tennessee owned serial number Fanso, Taurus, 2-inch barrel, 357 Magnum, 5-shot, I'm not bad about that. So what? Everybody in America knows I own a 1999 Crown Victoria. Anybody in Iowa can find out that I own a 1999 Crown Victoria. Somebody in bloody Australia can find out what car I own. What's the big deal to know that I own that damn pistol?
Right, and by extension, just by virtue of how often you use the two things comparatively, the 1999 Crown Vic is a hell of a lot more dangerous, not reflecting on your driving, but upon frequency of use in the law of averages.
But exactly, based on probabilities, you know, I endanger 400 or 500 citizens 6 days a week with that Crown Victoria. That pistol hasn't been moved in, let me see, I made sure it didn't have rust spots about 3 months ago. It hasn't been touched since.
There you go. David, wonderful conversation, brother.
Back to numerology.
Yes.
5145. Oh, we just had a change. 5345. Which way is it going, Bob?
That's still WVU.
You're exactly right. Come on, OV of little faith.
Well, look, I mean, this is already, just to take a sporting moment, this is already proving to be a rather interesting little Big East tournament.
Of course it is.
First of all, for the, you know, we had this this thing in place for years now where only the top 14 teams got in, but now everybody plays, including poor little DePaul, who hadn't won a Big East game all season and went in and humiliated Cincinnati by 10 points in the first round.
You know, there's that Hoosiers, the little guys deserve to be here once in a while moment.
Oh, one of these days I'm going to watch a 16 knock off a 1 in March, and I'm going to feel as good as any alum from that school.
It has to happen. We've already had a 15 do a 2, so it's got to happen. All right, take another caller that matters, would you?
Later, David.
See ya.
Bye now. Calling from Upper Middle Tennessee, our buddy David. And you know, the kind of wide-ranging, fun conversation, two of them tonight, that are the very soul of what happens on the horn. But I want to, as we move toward the end of the program, I want to extend a little bit, and I want to be careful about doing this, because the heartache in that little Alabama town is deep and profound. I don't even know if they've gotten to heartache yet. They're probably pretty much still at shock. And I grieve for them. I do. Southern folk are my folk. Mountain folk are my folk. And I know that I'm supposed to, you know, we're all Americans in there, and we are. But there's still a little last vestige of regionalism left. And as a born Southerner, and born to hillbilly West Virginian parents, I grieve for them and with them. I think our buddy Joe Bajant would probably be on board with what I say in that regard. But it really is, and when you get down toward Mobile County, Alabama, you start moving on down to, I can't remember exactly where it happened, but there was a famous battle called the Battle of Horseshoe Bend. Just nasty brutality among the invading whites and the First Peoples who lived in the region. And there really are a lot of people still in the South who come from stock where Papa did stand by the mud chinked log wall that had the rifle slit in it, and had his two squirrel rifles, and the one he wasn't shooting, Ma was loading. We will leave for a moment the philosophical discussion on the rightness or wrongness and why that had to be that way. But that is a long gone time. And I suppose I was a little bit facetious in mentioning it. But there is an overarching conversation that we do not have in this country, that we cannot have. I think in terms of public discussions, we are more likely to have a semi-civil debate in this country about whether or not there is a supreme deity than we are to have an honest discussion about the role of firearms in this regard, benighted society. And there is no better proof than Fox News. I give you Exhibit 1, a colloquy between Glenn Beck and Bill O'Reilly. Now, remember, it was Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity's books, and Michael Savage's, the Savage Wiener, his book, that were found in the possession of David Jim Adkisson after the investigation began about why he did what he did in the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. He laid a degree of moral, ethical, philosophical, social, and cultural culpability right on the doorstep of his heroes, Hannity, O'Reilly, and Savage Wiener. So I was struck a little bit by the fact that if there is a God, he is a God of irony. When I saw this exchange between Glenn Beck and Billow, because when we talk in big H, in terms of big H hypocrisy, this is one of those where it really knows no bounds. I mean, this is gold medal mantelpiece hypocrisy.
So the shooting in Alabama.
Yeah.
Did you hear how they described this guy? I mean, it was a typical, you know,
he was a loner. He was quiet. Didn't know. I mean, it was really.
But what they really described, when they really got down into it, what they said was, here's a guy who.
They. Notice the use of the Fox journalism style book.
Felt that he had been wronged. He didn't feel comfortable talking to anybody. He was disgruntled and everything else. And he went out and he shot a bunch of people.
Now stop. I promise you these two are going to go on and make even bigger fools of themselves than they already are. And they're going to prove themselves clueless, ignorant, bigoted, hate-filled fools and monsters of a very special stripe. But Beck just described the same guy that shot up the Tennessee Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. But he's so clueless, he doesn't know it. And did you notice the mockery at the beginning of it? The joking about the descriptions of the shooter.
So the shooting in Alabama.
Yeah.
Did you hear how
shooting in Alabama?
I mean, it was a typical. You know, he was a loner. He was quiet. Didn't know.
I mean, I do voices and stuff on the air. But wow, is that crass?
Oh, I mean, it was really. But what they really described, when they really got down into it, what they said was, here's a guy who felt that he had been wronged. He didn't feel comfortable talking to anybody. He was disgruntled and everything else.
In other words, he is a classic right-wing hate radio demographic listener. The people upon whom the O'Reillys and Becks and Hannitys and Flimballs and Bortzes and Ingrams and Savages, and on and on and on. Remember, for every hour of liberal talk, there is 1,000 hours of right-wing hate. Precisely the demographic that these monsters, this special brand of monstrosity, preys upon. Every hour that Glenn Beck or O'Reilly or Savage or Wiener or the rest of them are on the air, they're not trying to do what we do here, that is to close the space of isolation in this country. They're trying to make sure that that tormented individual out there understands that he's even more isolated than he thought he was. That there are even more people arrayed against him than he thought there were. And that the only thing he can do is patriotically take matters into his own hands.
And they shot a bunch of people. As they were describing him, and they said, you got to go, now more than ever, you got to start talking to people. You have to start connecting with people because we're going into hard times, yada, yada, yada. As I'm listening to the description.
So yada, 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 none of that really matters. Notice the disdain with which he treats it.
First of all, this guy's a psycho. Clearly he's a psycho.
Right.
But as I'm listening to him, I'm thinking about the American people that feel disenfranchised right now, that feel like nobody's hearing their voice. The government isn't hearing their voice.
Who tells them the government isn't hearing their voice? The government doesn't tell them the government isn't hearing their voice. The government doesn't send out the "we don't cover" letters to people with kidney disease and cancer. Daggummit, the insurance companies do. But who tells them that it's the government? Exhibit 1.
Even if you call, they don't listen to you on both sides. If you're a conservative, you're called a racist, you want to starve children, yada, yada, yada. And every time they do speak out...
And what are we called if we're a liberal, Glenn? Can you get to that? No, you can't bring that up, Glenn, because you've spent too much damn time on the public's airwaves saying that liberals and progressives and decent human beings are communists and socialists. That we don't love America. That we want America to lose. But see, 99% of the people watching this don't think that.
They're shut down by political correctness. How do you not have those people turn into that guy?
Let me step in before O'Reilly does. Well, the first thing we do, Glenn, is we get them to turn off your sorry ass. That's just me.
Look, nobody, even if they're frustrated, is going to hurt another human being unless they're mentally ill, I think.
Yeah, you got to think that, Bill, because there's dead people in Knoxville, Tennessee, who were dead at your connivance, you son of a bitch!
Pushed to the wall. You don't think people get pushed to the wall?
I don't believe in the snap thing. I think that kind of violence is in...
I don't believe in it either, Bill, because I believe that people need day in and day out, year in and year out... The poisoning of their minds by the likes of you and your buddy Beck and Flimbaugh and Ingram and Bortz and Savage and Levin and all of the... For once in his life, he's right. It's not just a matter of people snapping. It's people being driven like cattle to the gun closet. Driven by these people.
Inside you, and it's a personality disorder. But I do understand the frustration of people. But it's called fighting the good fight. That's what it's called, fighting the good fight. You stand up for your belief system. You tell people what you believe. You take the slings and arrows. Both you do.
Say what? Shooting up a couple of small Alabama towns is fighting the good fight? How much longer is this guy going to be left on the airwaves? Just ask him.
I do. We have to take it. But you fight. You fight for your country. You fight for your family. You fight for your dignity. And that's it. And you don't hurt other people in the process. You just fight the good fight.
All by way of excusing the next one that comes down the pike. I don't know about you, but that makes my blood run cold. They have the nerve to discuss this on the air and empower the next disaffected white guy who says, well, might as well go out in a blaze of glory. O'Reilly and Beck and them done told me America, and Hannity told me America's going to hell, going to have socialized medicine, going to have nationalized banks. Hammer and sickle be flying over the Capital any day now. By God, I'll let them know I was here and I fought against their communist plot. Yeah? Yeah. mean, that's what it is, isn't it? Am I overreaching here? Have I got it wrong? You're free to disagree, and we'll work through it together. But I sincerely believe I'm right. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Preston.
Did you hear the guy in Alabama, I guess, was kicked out? Did you hear about that?
Say again. I think I lost you there. Kicked out of where?
The Marines.
No.
Yeah, I believe that's what I heard during a radio news segment just a few moments ago, actually. Yeah, but apparently he, you know, they let him go, the Marines or something like that, if I heard it correctly. So
he was too nuts for the Marines?
Yeah.
I mean, could we send him home with like a little tag on his shirt? Too nuts for the too psycho for the Marines? I mean, I'm not trying to be crass, but could we just?
Well, you know, they can make him kind of nutty at times. Maybe he didn't make his bed the right way or something. And
yeah, you could only bounce a dime off the mattress and not a whole quarter.
Right.
Oh, that's distressing in the extreme. Now, there was some good news out of Alabama today, though, Preston.
What is that?
One of the few places in liberal radio where this has been discussed, this petty, petulant little martinet who serves as the Attorney General of Alabama, Troy King. John Fox performed a brilliant parody of him a while back. Troy King, it turns out, is under federal investigation now. And that just makes me so dadgum happy. It makes me think that now that Barack Obama is in office, we might see the Department of Justice trying to do the right thing once in a while. Because Troy King, among other things, used his office to persecute political opponents, to bring charges against people, elected officials in counties who had opposed his policies. And the Birmingham News reported today that at least six former employees of King's office were called before a federal grand jury in Montgomery last week and asked about issues related to gambling. And King's propensity for using his office to investigate political appointees, you know, Nixon style.
Yep. That's good to hear. And some more good news regarding the Obama administration. Did you hear about Van Jones?
Yes, I did, and I do find that exciting. And I hope that our liaison for Appalachia will work hard with Green for All, who has a new executive director, and B, that somebody will get the message through to Van Jones. I hope maybe I did a little bit of good a week or so ago just talking to him.
Oh, you had a chance to meet him?
Yeah, I met him backstage at Power Shift.
Oh, good. Yeah. In case your listeners don't know, Van Jones wrote the book The Green Collar Economy. He was appointed to be some kind of advisor on green jobs for the Obama administration. He actually was on C-SPAN a couple weekends ago at a book talk. And, yeah, it's exciting. You know, it's those kind of appointments. You know, we lost the Freeman appointment, because he wasn't lockstep on the Israeli government playbook. You know, he,
right,
you know, was sympathetic to the Palestinians here and there. So he had to go. You know, Dennis Prager, he's basically AIPAC radio, the Israeli lobby radio. When I heard him going on and on and on about this person, I knew it was on to stop this guy. So it was disappointing to see him drop out. But there are these other appointments that go on that don't go through such a process of critique sometimes. And, you know, he'll be there. And I think actually Hilda Solis, the labor secretary, who I think a lot of people want to stop, I think she's going to get the ceremony to be inducted is going to be tomorrow, I believe. So,
well, I have great hopes for Hilda Solis. And backing up just a minute, just to not to throw water on anything, but I was disturbed by the fact that Chaz Freeman's nomination was torpedoed once again by the Israeli lobby. And that's not paranoia. That's a simple fact. The right wing made it clear that he was not sufficiently deferential to whatever the homicidal policies the Israelis tended to enact in terms of the lack of proportionality for their attacks in Gaza. He was targeted, and they said so for that. However, I got to put a little caveat on it because I have read some of Chaz Freeman's other thinkings, and some of them are quite disturbing, Preston.
Okay. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me either.
I mean, these people run around in this national security world, which is a very different world from where you and I live.
Yeah.
Manifestly more paranoid, manifestly more willing to see the boogeymen around under every corner and under every bed. And I read some comments from him about the Chinese government's response to Tiananmen Square, that, and I've used this phrase again a couple of times tonight, that made a chill run down my spine.
Okay, yeah.
He said that the biggest problem with Tiananmen Square, Preston, was the fact that the Chinese government did not come out and squash the students like a bug the minute the thing started, and instead gently allowed the protest to get legs, so to speak.
Wow. Yeah.
And then he went on to say something that really got the little hairs standing up on the back of my neck, to wit, I cannot imagine that the United States government would ever allow 2 million people to occupy the seat of government and make any sort of demands dispersing the crowd immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, we certainly saw that, too, when those WTO protests and the World Bank protests were starting up. I mean, that was an incredibly repressive response that people faced. I mean, the Seattle moment was incredible, incredible moment in history, and the establishment didn't want that to happen again. So it got increasingly brutal and lots of surveillance and stuff like that. And, rubber bullets and so on and so forth. It really just traumatized a lot of people, actually, who were involved with those. And, they focused a lot of attention on the Black Bloc anarchists, sort of anarchists. And, were they doing property damage and stuff like that? Probably some provocateurs in their midst.
Oh, I don't. That's the one thing that I feel absolutely certain about. The damage aspect. I mean, when we've got evidence of it, and we do, lots and lots of evidence of it. How can you not think that some of it is agent provocateur behavior?
And always skipping the larger issues, the context, the real debates over these trade policies and neoliberal economics and austerity measures for countries that are driven into debt and the selling off of resources and the privatization of industries and government jobs and destruction of unions and on and on and on. Things that most of the population would be sympathetic to, but you don't discuss that. You focus attention someplace else. I wanted to go real quickly back to the Marines. There's a documentary called The Ground Truth, which was about, some veterans from the Iraq invasion and Afghanistan and the activities that they were involved with and the training they went through and the chants they were singing about, Arab people being like bugs to squash, and this woman who was going through the training and was jogging and, being encouraged to join in this chant. She was like, oh my God, they want us to say this. But she was like, there was that group setting and you kind of just go with the flow. And she said she was doing it herself. So there's that dehumanization going on. And, towards the people that we're saying we're liberating. But there are so many Marines who have served this country and, within that system in heroic ways. And I'm thinking about when I learned how to do it, to create a little you know, fan page. There's already a fan page for Smedley Butler, General Smedley Butler.
I'm
sure you're familiar with him.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Okay. Well, he's got a fan page. And he was he won the Congressional Medal of Honor twice. But after 30 years, he had a transformation for a variety of reasons and stepped out from what he was doing and became a very big critic of, you know, not the Marine or not the military per se, but of militarism and of war. And he talked about how, well, he wrote the book War is a Racket. And he was known as the Fighting Quaker because he was a Quaker himself and, you know, highly decorated guy. But anyway, if I get a chance, I'm going to start a little club on Facebook about advocating for a stamp for Smedley Butler.
Oh, good idea.
I think he's deserving of it.
The only guy in American military history to win two Congressional Medals of Honor? I mean, come on.
Yep, that's right. But, you know, there's that controversy of that book he wrote and, you know, that incredible part of our history, how in, I think it's 1934, where some rich industrialists try to recruit him to overthrow FDR. And these industrialists did not like this, the spirit of some of these New Deal policies at all. And they tried to recruit Smedley Butler to do this military coup, and he exposed it. And it was investigated by some congressional committee that pretty much confirmed what he was saying about it. But they didn't press charges or anything like that. And the same business interests, they continue. They didn't stop the fight. You know, they were unsuccessful in their military coup, but, you know, their spirit lives on with Rush Limbaugh saying, you know, some of those New Deal policies still exist, but we're going to do something about that.
And my friends, it's socialism.
That's right. Not a military coup. Tactics. Kind of like, you know, one thing they did was co-opt the fireside chat. You know, they saw how FDR could communicate with people through the radio.
And they use it every day, and they radicalize and militarize ordinary working Americans. You know, one of the things, Preston, that just struck me as a special brand of horrifying about this shooter in Alabama. It turns out that in 2006, he and his mother were among Pilgrim's Pride employees who filed a lawsuit against the Pilgrim's Pride over claims of unfair compensation.
Interesting.
You know, and he had a notebook that included names of coworkers, including one who reported him for not wearing earplugs, another one who made him clean a meat grinder, and a supervisor who didn't like the way he cut pork chops. Now, this is a plant in South Alabama. Anybody, would you dare take a bet with me that this was not a union shop?
Right.
It's a place where workers have no rights, where the only right a worker has is to shut up and do your job or go home and get fired and starve to death, wind up on the streets, and this guy winds up angry?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Dehumanizing work, for sure.
There you go. And so, you know, it makes, it makes even more pathetic and laughable the fact that O'Reilly's only excuse for this is that some people are just psychos.
Right. All those oversimplifications that they're always doing.
I mean, the girl was interviewed who was one of his classmates from kindergarten all the way through high school graduation. She said he always had his shirt tucked in, and he didn't pull none of them other pranks that the boys pulled, and he was never at none of the parties getting in trouble like none of the other boys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe if the other boys had reached out to him a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe if he'd had his shirt untucked. Maybe if that supervisor hadn't said, son, you just don't cut the pork chops right, and I tell you what, we're going to have to dock you pay.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't cut the pork chops better. But
yep.
I got to roll out of here. We're right on top of it, Preston, and
okay.
I hope we'll talk soon.
That'll be good.
All right, later.
Take care, Bob.
Bye now. So that's the end of what turned out to be a wonderful program. Thank you again for all your kind words and wishes for Ferg. Thank you to Ben Birch, the hardest working man in liberal talk, saving liberal talk on the internet with WhiteRoseSociety.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org. and responsible for every single packet that streams from here to your computer through the servers of White Rose Society. Thanks to John Fox in the middle of a move. Poor fellow. He's got my sympathy. Thanks to Peter Godbold, our IT professional. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. They stand and fight upstream because they understand that we are all downstream. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. We now have, of course, President Obama directing things. And many people, including some would say the president, say it's time to move on. We've got major problems, of course, the economy and of course, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and President Obama has a lot on his plate. But some say that it's a little too soon to turn the page on the Bush administration, that the things they did were not just bad policy. They were beyond the pale of constitutional law, beyond the pale of humanity, that they actually rise to the level of war crimes. And one of the people that's saying that is my guest today. He is Michael Ratner. He is the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he's the author of a book which is really more like a legal brief than a book, called The Trial of Donald Rumsfeld. Michael Ratner, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Mark, I've always loved to be on your show, and I'm glad it's around.
Well, I thank you very much, and I'm really glad to have you, and I want to know all about your book. Before we get there, though, explain to our listeners why it's difficult to bring suit in the United States against Don Rumsfeld and the other neocons who did torture and extraordinary rendition and all the acts that you talk about in your brief?
Well, you know, I think if we had a Justice Department right now and maybe an independent prosecutor who would at least start a criminal investigation of what I call the torture program, particularly among high officials, Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld, Tenet, et cetera, I think we could get prosecution. And interestingly, right now, of course, they're having a big debate in this country. I'm part of it, as to what should the Obama administration do about the fact that this country essentially went off the page of the prohibition of against torture and had a torture program. And that debate varies from, as you opened, saying, let's move on and not do anything. Let's set up a truth commission, which is sort of a Leahy-type thing, Senator Leahy. Or let's go to where the Center for Constitutional Rights and a number of other human rights groups are going. Let's have a criminal investigation. So that debate is still going on right now here. But we don't know how it's going to come out completely. Obama, as you said, is saying turn the page, look forward. My view is, you know, is that somewhat disingenuous, because my view is that looking forward is looking forward to a country that doesn't torture. And the way you do that is you prosecute people to deter torture in the future. Not really looking back, looking forward.
Even though you filed suit in Germany, you haven't given up on the possibility of filing suit in the United States.
Yeah, we did the German suit in 2004 and 2006. At that point, it was impossible. The Bush administration was in power. The Justice Department was headed by Gonzalez for a while, then Mukasey. They weren't going to do it. The military part of the possibility here of trials was headed by Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. They weren't going to do it. At that point, we were foreclosed from ever getting prosecution here. It was right now on the European cases, and I think they're going to be very good cases, ultimately, and it's going to be difficult for some of the key torture conspiracy people, Bush, Rumsfeld, et al., to travel to Europe. I think right now we're in the midst of a debate here in this country about it, and Europe will hold its hand. The European courts won't move until they see that the United States, which really has the primary obligation to investigate torturers on its own territory, whether it's going to do that or not. If it does not, then it would go to Europe.
Well, I was just going to say, I thought you'd already filed. I know you filed in 2004, and the court said that, in essence, it's a political decision because Rumsfeld and the rest of them are still in power, right?
Well, here's what happened. We filed in